Tonight on The Download, Bulls basketball writer Sam Smith, the owner of La Familia Green, Molly Green, and we play The Worst with Kristen Toomey and Darren Worrell. Now, here's your host, a man who will bake a cake for anybody, Justin Kaufman.
It's absolutely true. I will bake a cake for anybody. Hint, I don't know how. It's the only downside to my promise is that it'll probably turn out terrible. But on principle, I'll bake a cake for anybody. But I give you my promise. I also give you a promise it will be terrible. So download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got an awesome show lined up tonight. I love them. I love Tuesday nights because we get to play the worst. Complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Kristen Toomey, one of our regulars, great stand-up comedian in Chicago, who's a regular at so many different stages, will be in studio tonight. Looking forward to having her back in. Also tonight, we're going to talk with Sam Smith, the longtime sports writer, writes about basketball and the Bulls for Bulls.com. He also has a new book called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. He talks about the early pioneers of the sport, including Oscar Robertson, changed the game forever, and pretty much essentially talking about how they fought for the rights that the players today are granted and the rights that provide them billion-dollar contracts. They weren't so back in the 60s and 70s of the NBA and the ABA. We'll talk with Sam Smith about that, the author of The Jordan Rules, one of my favorite writers, one of my favorite books, The Jordan Rules. It's so great. Sam Smith at the big table. How fun is that? Always great to have Sam Smith.
I always feel like a kind of a dope when somebody asks you your favorite book of all time and it's a sports book. It happens to me all the time. Like, oh yeah, you know, superior running backs of the 80s is, you know.
I'm going to take that from you. Anyone ever asks me, what's your favorite book? Superior running backs of the 80s. The whole thing on Billy Sims and Earl Monroe. That's wonderful. Or Earl Campbell. That's Earl Campbell, right? Is James Wilder in there? There's so many good running backs in the 80s. Oh, man, don't get me started. 80s running backs. Also tonight, we're going to talk about driverless technology. We keep talking about the future of driverless technology. Well, the future is now. Whether it's Uber or Tesla or Volvo or anyone in between, autonomous vehicles are getting closer and closer, if not already on the road. So we resurrect our segment we've been doing all through 2017, the How to Improve Blank. Today we'll talk about how to get ready for autonomous vehicles and driverless technology. What do we need to know? What are the rules? The rules of the roads have to change? What do we need to know both as taxpayers and drivers when it comes to implementing and being safe and also understanding driverless technology and driverless cars on the road today? We'll have that conversation coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And The Download in Chicago Business coming up here after 7:30. Molly Green in studio. Molly, friend of The Download, of course, and also the owner of La Familia Green. We'll talk about her work in printmaking and screen printing. Is that the thing? Put those two things together, printmaking, screen printing. But essentially, I've seen it described so many different ways online today. Stationary design was one. This is a nice combo. So we'll talk about stationary design. Got it. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Today, former President Barack Obama, was back in Chicago to speak at the Mayor's Climate Change Summit. Did he talk about kneeling at football games? How about a trial in San Francisco? Did he call out Pocahontas or fake news? None of that? And he considers himself presidential. I like my politics like I like my social media. Flaming. The North American Climate Change Summit brought together 52 mayors from 10 countries, and they all signed a pledge to lower carbon emissions, even if our federal government is asleep at the wheel. dumping toxins into the lake. So then you just sleep at the wheel, and then you back that car up that you're asleep in right to the lake and just dump the stuff right in. And now the summit's over. So you know what that means. Party time. What's the plan? What's the plan tonight, Mayors? Let me know. I'll catch up after the show. Maybe start with a Tom and Jerry over at Miller's Pub. And get yourself one of those meatballs in the Italian village. Then go on all out after the get an after party going at Bub City. You know, maybe one of Billy Deck's joints. Hit up a 4 a.m. bar in Pilsen. End up at some dude's apartment in Bridgeport watching him play video games. It's a lot to do. Stumble to the Pink Monkey in the South Loop till the sun comes up. Come on, Mayors. Then all you got to do is roll right to the airport and walk around the terminal in sunglasses, chugging Dasani like it's going out of style. These are just suggestions. Or you could go low-key. Just go over to Ed Burke's house. You know he's got a good man cave. Wood-paneled basement. Probably catch a Nicolas Cage movie on TNT. Again, I'm just giving you Mayor's suggestions. Or you could just stand in line at Garrett's all night. It's one of those three things. In other news, the filings are in for the 2018 elections. 11 people are running for Luis Gutierrez's congressional seat. And State Representative Jeannie Ives is in for the Republican gubernatorial primary. She called Governor Rauner Benedict Rauner today. I love it. Saying he betrayed Illinois conservatives like a traitor. So like he stole plans or something in the middle of the night. Oh, traitor because he didn't vote the way you wanted him to. Got it. Well, hang him. Get him. I mean, vote him out. I just love it. I give points to Jeannie Ives early. I hope it's a campaign full of fun puns. Benedict Rauner. So cute. Gay cakes are back in the news, and I'm afraid they're probably going to stay in the news for a while. Arguments were heard today at the Supreme Court on whether or not a Colorado baker has to serve gay people. I'm sure it's more nuanced than that, but really, is it? Because I think that's what it's about. The lawyer for the Trump administration argued that they would put a sign in the window saying that they don't serve gay couples. Oh, so very 1950s of us. So people don't want to take money from gay people because of their religious beliefs. And observers say that the Supreme Court will make that the rule of the land. I mean, that's where they're heading, perhaps. You can't discriminate against someone because of their religious beliefs. But in this case, you can discriminate against someone if by serving them would be discriminatory. Remember the old saying, wedding cakes don't kill people. Gay wedding cakes do. I'm confused. So confused. Russia was banned from the 2018 Winter Olympics. When reached for comment, Russia said, meh, who needs the Olympics? We already got our gold. Huh? That's good. That's good, right? Now Russia and Senate candidate Roy Moore have something in common. Maybe Moore could go to the Olympics for Russia, and Russia could go to the mall for Moore, right? Pick me something up at Forever 21. McDonald's unveiled their new value menu, and newsrooms across the country dedicated resources to this. The burger is only a dollar? Two crews, wide angle. I want round-the-clock coverage. When I see that the triple cheeseburger is only a dollar, I stay away from the triple cheeseburger, right? Call me an elitist. But I don't see the value paying $1 for three patties of meat. That's not meat. Flex dynamic pricing has hit expressways outside of Washington, D.C. And to take the express lanes yesterday during the morning commute, drivers had to pay a $40 toll. $40? I'm not kidding. That's a lot of money to get a little bit further, quicker. $40. Where's the tweet on this, Prez? $40 to take a highway in America. Now that's against my religion. In weather, welcome to the rest of the winter. Right here, this is it. Sunny, cold, and windy till April. I guess I'm okay with it. We had that quick reprieve, which I asked for, and we got it, so I'm good. Also, wildfires in Cali, 0% containment. You never want to get a stat that's 0% anything, but 0% containment? Not good. In sports, well, Pete called it out yesterday. Chicago sports are in a rut right now. 0-12, or maybe it's 0-13 now. The Bulls losing last night to the Cavaliers. All of Chicago sports is 0-4 for the last week or so. Last night, the Bulls got dismantled by the upstart Cleveland Cavaliers. They won their 12th in a row, made it easy work of the baby Bulls. D-Wade was back in the house. He had to show off and drop 24 on us. Because why not? I know D-Wade's from Robbins and he was a Bull, but, I mean, could there be a worse ex-Bull out there than Dwayne Wade? I mean, He made zero impression while he was here, and he got bought out of his contract to go play somewhere else in Cleveland. I don't know. He just rubs me the wrong way. I'll be the first to say it. I have no love lost for Dwayne Wade with his capri pants and his sleeveless suit. I might fly in Cleveland, but not in this working-class city like Chicago. We don't like the sleeveless suit. Mirotić might come back this week. Zach LaVine is practicing, although early timetables had him back in November. And last I checked, it's not November anymore. But why race back? The Bulls are 3-19 and in full-on tank mode. Purposely tanking in Chicago, the number three sports market in the country. How did it come to this? Ugh. The Bears had a day off. Some of them spent it at the Children's Hospital playing Santa for sick kids. I think I speak for everyone when I say, get back to work. Oh, I don't speak for everybody? That was just me? That was just me. I take that back. Full disclaimer. I'm alone on this one. Got it. Kyle Long was put on the IR today. He tried to gut out several injuries this year, and, well, it didn't work out. He didn't play much, and he's missing the last four games of the season again. Also, the Bears have a new kicker, rock star Ted Nugent's on the Bears now. Oh, sorry, read that wrong. Mike Nugent. Nah. If you're going to get a Nugent, get Ted. Nobody wants Mike. We want Ted. The Bears play the Bengals in the Queen City, home to the funk music on Sunday. So you know the Bears are going to bring the funk, smell the whole place up. Although the Bengals got banged up bad last night in a helmet-to-helmet hit parade on national television and lost to the Steelers. So they lost three of their stars to injury last night and are essentially out of the playoffs. So statement game, Bengals win 34-0. Blackhawks are back on the ice tomorrow after losing four in a row. And four in a row is actually okay in Chicago sports right now. That's the win. That's the class. It could be worse. Wake me when they lose 10 in a row. And finally tonight, Twitter has released its top tweets of 2017. Former President Barack Obama was second with a tweet about Nelson Mandela. But the first place tweet was that of a teenager trying to get free chicken nuggets from Wendy's. It just goes to show you that if you use Twitter to highlight injustices in the world, it will never be as popular as processed meat. That's the carryout for December 5th, 2017. Speaking of processed meat, that's our special today. We put all the processed meat we have in one nugget, although it's less of a nugget and more of a chunk. But we give you barbecue sauce, so that's good. All right, coming up, the download on Chicago Business. Molly Green is here. We'll talk about her stationery design company. Also coming up at 8 o'clock, the author of Hard Labor, the battle that birthed the billion-dollar NBA, Sam Smith, will be at the big table. It's coming up on the download in 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Yeah, question of the day. Windy enough for you? How many times have I heard that?
I'll call it the windy.
Yeah, it could be a little windier. Yeah, maybe gusts of 100 miles per hour. Then I could really chase my crap all over the neighborhood.
I know. I think, today we have like an inflatable snowman that we put up in our little front foyer.
Mm-hmm.
And today I made the choice to not plug it in. Like it because I plugged it in and it started to get real crazy and the tethers were in trouble and I was like, you know what, we're shutting it down. Wind advisory.
Yeah, I think those little aluminum stakes that they give you with these items probably are only wind tested to about 12 miles per hour.
That's exactly it.
And my poor neighbor, you know, he does a good job. He puts his stuff out in the front lawn. So I had about a half dozen of his plastic candy canes in my yard this morning. It was nice.
Candy cane cleanup.
Right.
There you go.
It's business time.
Yes, it's time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment where we talk with entrepreneurs and CEOs about their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, let's talk small press greeting cards for the holiday season. Of course, Hallmark and other card companies make millions this time of year, offering options for Christmas cards. But more often than not, consumers are looking for more personalized or unique products to send their friends and family. Enter Molly Green. Besides being a friend to the download, Molly is the owner of one of Chicago's best independent companies, La Familia Green. She produces cards, wrapping paper, magnets, and buttons from scratch in her Rogers Park space and has been doing it since 2005. La Familia Green is a fixture on the design scene here in Chicago, with products in hundreds of stores all over the world, and you can find her work in national outlets like Paper Source or Urban Outfitters. Like I said, Molly's a friend to the download, married to our producer Pete, and she is in studio tonight. Molly, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
So I've always been a fan of your work, and you have had such success here in Chicago in the design scene. Talk about how it started. La Familia started back in 2005.
I went to school at the Art Institute. I graduated in 2000, and I did painting and drawing and printmaking, and I liked multiples, but I did really big, messy pieces, and when I graduated, you don't have that luxury anymore. So I ended up working at a card store, Paperboy, on Belmont,
right.
Its sister store, Uncle Fun, across the street was an iconic vintage toy store. And the owner liked to hire artists and let us do all the buying and all the merchandising, and then we could sell what we made there, too. And this was the early 2000s, and letterpress printing was beginning to make a comeback. This really old technique was coming back in fashion, and people were making cards. And I was not feeling inspired by getting my work into galleries, and back then taking slides around with you, and it just seemed really
overwhelming. That's how you get your work in a gallery, right? Is right. You have to show up with a portfolio, right?
So I could make cards, put them on the shelf, and people would buy them, and that was it. Boom, I had an audience.
You know, it's amazing, too, to think about working in that kind of experience in a retail, a brick-and-mortar store. You think about it, and yeah, that's a great training ground for starting your own business.
Yeah, so we, you know, I met with reps, and I looked at catalogs, and found out about trade shows and learned all that part of it and how to approach a store and what stores liked and what they didn't and what sold. It was an education. It was my grad school.
And we'll get to the business part of it. Before that, though, what were you producing? What's your style? What, in 2005, when you're starting and you say, I want to get into this card business, I have ideas. What are you putting on the actual, what are you designing?
Well, I had always done screen printing, and so I kind of continued printmaking and that bold, colorful graphic style. And I like things that are humorous and things that are really specific. And it's just like I just keep a list of ideas, and it's what stands out to me. I think I'm pretty observant, and so I think my following has the same sensibility as me. People always, when I do like a craft fair, come up to me and say, oh, we would be friends. I love this and this and this that I represent.
But there's something about the work that does definitely play in that form in community and sensibility and being able to relate to customers, because, you know, that's always, you always think about cards, and that's what you're doing when you're looking at a section in a store.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at cards that is going to say something to the person you're sending it to.
And I think I'm successful because I think about it from the standpoint of I think this is funny, I think this is notable, as opposed to, oh, I need to make a unicorn card because that's going to sell.
Right.
So I'm trying to come at from a more organic
Well,
place.
It's one thing to be able to make a unique piece of art and put it on a card or a button or a magnet or wrapping paper, but it's entirely another thing to make a business out of it, to mass produce it. How do you deal with the scale of it? How do you deal with, you know, you come up with an idea for a card, you put it all together. How do you get that to Urban Outfitters?
When I started, I made everything by hand, and Anthropology picked up some cards, and I could not fulfill that order. So I started working with a printer, and so the printer prints for me, and I print digitally, and that gives me a lot of flexibility, so I can order 5,000 of something, or I can order 100 of it, so I can be kind of experimental.
So having a relationship with a printer.
Yeah, I'm not committed to ordering a huge quantity.
What do you mean with Anthropology, you weren't be able to fulfill it? They came in and said, we love your work, we want a gazillion of them.
Pretty much.
And you're sitting there like, all right, I can't, there's no way I can do that.
Yeah, so that's when I found my printer, and I'm still working with them. And as far as like how you get into Urban Outfitters, I have sales reps that work for me and represent me at trade shows, and so they're going to see things there. But really, I think they see things in other stores, or they see things on Instagram, and it's just, even though these companies are huge, it's just a small group of buyers, and you get to know them personally. And so it's easy to work with them and to approach them, and they're excited about this field and that there's a lot going on in independent greeting cards.
Well, let's do this. Let's talk more about the business side and the hustle that goes into putting together a small business around stationary design, wrapping paper, magnets, buttons, everything that happens at La Familia Green. Molly Green in studio, my guest tonight, the Download in Chicago Business. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More conversation. Stay with us.
It's business time.
Molly Green in studio with us. La Familia Green is the name of her company. She's a fixture on the design scene here in Chicago. Does cards, wrapping paper, magnets, and buttons from scratch in her Rogers Park space. And we're talking about what it takes to be an artist who's also a business person. in the way that I know so many artists who are like, the one thing that's the worst thing about my business is that it's a business. And I want to be an artist. I don't want to be in business. How do you approach that? How do you approach the idea that there are artists out there that see it as two different brains?
For me, I like the combination, but I know that there are other card lines out there that are more business savvy than me, with people running those who have MBAs and went to school for business and not making cards or not drawing or printmaking or painting. So I just try to fill in the holes. And I know like some companies that have inventory systems that cost them like $6,000 a year to maintain. And I have a yellow legal pad as my inventory system. And I have an accountant and I have a bookkeeper. And so I am relying on some people for help on the things that I'm not as good at or don't want to do.
Well, I mean, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the idea that you have to get your stuff in front of buyers and I would assume in front of stores in that way to be able to expand. What is, I mean, do you think about expansion? Do you think about growth in the way that you've had so much success to have your cards in stores like Urban Outfitters or Paper Source, or even in the situation when Anthropologie put the big order in years ago? Do you think about the idea of scaling and getting bigger and bigger and what it would take to do that?
I do, and I've grown a little bit every year, and I always hope that one big exciting thing happens every year. But I really, it's the most important to me is to maintain my smaller accounts and then just to keep doing good work, and then the orders will follow. That's my approach to it, and it's worked.
Is
so
this,
far.
I mean, I think about it because it is interesting that this for you is considered the busy time, but the busy time is actually a couple months ago because the idea of filling orders and putting all the holiday orders together for the stores just mentioned and the hundreds of stores that are on your website that are right now have your holiday cards in stock. You're thinking ahead. You're already as a business, you're thinking about spring, summer, Easter, whatever mm-hmm. it might be, but Christmas and the holidays, it's in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, I was making Mother's Day and Father's Day cards today and I'm actually kind of late. It's it's been busier later this year and so I normally have all of that done by now and I'm shooting it for my new catalog. And so now I'm scrambling to get that done while I'm trying to fill orders for people just buying cards on my website or ordering custom cards. So most stores place their holiday orders during the summer and we ship it to them in September or October. They start putting them on the shelves in October. And those orders are large. So that dominates the fall.
That's your fall work. You know, I think about it, there's a lot of people in this space. When you talk about stationary design or greeting cards or anything that goes along with independent design, there are a lot of artists that get into that space. And I guess the question I have for you is what do you have to do to make yourself stand out? Because you've had success in the way that you have stood out. Then I mean, you're La Familia Green and your company, you're sort of the red letter or the top brand in Chicago when it comes to independent printing. How do you stand out against or stand out when so many people want to be in this business?
I think it's a combination of things. You have to have your own voice and be unique. There's a lot of copycats in this business and one style will get hot and then everyone will copy it. And then that's oversaturated and the consumer is ready to move on from that. I think you have to have a quality product. It's really important to me that I have well-printed cards on good paper with good envelopes in a properly fitting sleeve and good labels. That makes a big difference, those little details, those little touches.
Do you have to push against going with the trend when you see something going hot and you're like, I could do that? Do you have to push against yourself to say, I don't want to go there because I got to stay what's true to what I'm doing here?
I really do. I really make what I like. And so sometimes maybe that does fall into a trend, or I comment on the trend. Cactuses were big, and I had a card that said I was into cactuses before they were cool. So that's my take, on the trend. And instead of just being totally trendy, I'll just sprinkle it in here or there.
As a veteran of the brick and mortar stationery world here in Chicago, as someone who worked at Paperboy on Belmont, how is Chicago for both the city and the consumer when it comes to the independent business? Where are we in 2017? Because I feel like I was just thinking when I was looking at all the stuff, I'm like, all these stores that used to be these card stores that you'd go to, independent places, they're not around anymore. As it all moved to the internet, and how is Chicago for this kind of work?
Well, I think one way that you stay in demand is to evolve. And so the evolution has been that, yeah, a lot of the stores that were just paper or card-based have gone away. And maybe that's because people aren't ordering invitations as much as they used to. Maybe just that generation is moving on to something else, and newer stores are opening up that are more combination of gift and clothing and home goods. Mm-hmm. And they have a card rack or they have a card wall. And I think Chicago is very into supporting small and local. There are so many holiday markets right now, and everything is about shop local, shop small. And we're searching for that community. And so there's something really nice about going and buying something directly from the person that made it and having a conversation with that person. I feel a lot better about that than going to buy something anonymous at a big store.
Well, big part of the design and craft community in studio tonight. Molly Green, La Familia Green is the company. You can find it online at lafamiliagreen.com. Molly, great to see you, the friend
thanks,
of the
Justin.
Download, and thanks for being on the Download of Chicago Business. Pete, Molly did great. She taught me a lot about stationery design.
Yeah.
As I was hoping, so that was good.
Yeah.
You guys have a podcast coming out here, which this we should do at least an hour and a half on. I think we're going to do that on Thursday. But what are you guys doing?
We are doing a podcast. It's called Molly and Pete Save Christmas, where we break down Hallmark Christmas movies. We watch them for you, and we talk about them. Because we love them.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
I saw some, they have a whole, is it the kind of Christmas movie that they constantly, each year, it's like a tradition, the same ones, or do they order new ones?
There's like 25 new ones a year.
What?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
When does the podcast start, tonight?
Tonight.
All right. Check out WGNRadio.com, something like that.
Yeah. Google
check,
it.
Check your feed. That's the lazy way to say it. Something's coming up. Check the feed.
It'll be on the website, I think. It'll show up somewhere.
Go. It's trending. It'll be trending.
If I'm not available for my 8:30, I'm listening to the podcast.
Yeah, there you go. There it is. All right. Well, check it out. There it is. That podcast, of course, available at WGN Plus. Molly Green, Pete Zimmerman. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest at the big table tonight is one of my favorite sports writers in Chicago. Sam Smith is the award-winning writer who used to write for the Trib, now writes for Bulls.com. He's also the author of several books, including one of Chicago's greatest, The Jordan Rules. So great. Smith's new book is another gem. It's called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. In it, Smith explores the early days of the NBA and the ABA, and the players who put their careers on the line to fight for financial equality. Guys like Oscar Robertson, who along with other players took on the NBA and won. But he paid the price. Robertson, as well as guys like Rick Barry, Bob Cousy, Elgin Baylor, Chet Walker, just to name a few, ultimately paved the way for players like LeBron James, Steph Curry, and even mid-level stars like Robin Lopez to make the millions they make today. Sam Smith in studio with me tonight at the big table. Sam, appreciate you being here. Thanks.
No, thank you, Justin.
It's great.
Great to be here.
This
great
book,
to be back in the Tribune building.
they haven't let
me back in for about a decade, so I got patted down as I walked in.
This book is an investigative piece, but it's also a history lesson, and it's also, if anything, a letter to say, hey, we have to treat the players of the NBA history better. What made you write this? What made you go back into the stories of some of these great players from the 60s?
Yeah, a couple of elements, but two things. It essentially is a history, and a history of, I'll offer my money back guarantee. If you can't find, if you know the NBA and you can't find 100 things you didn't know before, I'll give you your money back.
So true.
So you can find me at the United Center most game nights. But really, that was the fun of it, that there's so much about Wilt and Russell, Arbach, and this great era, Rick Barry, and you know, the reason he didn't smile because his teeth were crooked all the time. I mean, stuff you just didn't know. Anyway, but what, you know, the inspiration for it, and I don't want to go back, even though I was there at the tail end of the writing of the Federalist Papers. But, you know, it was something that, not because of what the situation with Thomas Jefferson, but just to make the long story short, when he, at the end of his life, he was essentially bankrupt because he lived so well.
Lavishly, right.
And, in effect, people around the country, he tried to have a lottery, and people around the country just simply started sending him money, shopkeepers and farmers, and because for everything he meant to the country and what he did. And that's sort of a message to me with the NBA players. You hear so much. And I wouldn't have done this like 5 or 6 years ago. The money coming in with the new TV deals has been so extraordinary that the average salary is essentially $8 million. Average salary. It's extraordinary. You know, John Havlicek, and I'll get into it because sort of like my writing, I drift all over the place.
No, I gotcha.
But Havlicek told me this story during the Celtics run. He was, it was in the book too, and he was one of the plaintiffs of this suit we'll get to. But he was making $20,000 a year, and so he went into Arbach and asked for a raise for $25,000. Arbach said, "You got to be completely nuts. Your career's over. You can't play. If you think you're going to make $25,000, you might as well retire and go somewhere else." And so he. John Havlicek, who was an all-star, leading scorer on the team, main
one of
player.
Biggest names in the NBA history, right?
Got a $1,000 raise to $21,000. And so that era of players, even though there's been pensions, although a lot of guys had to opt out of the pensions, they don't get all the pension increases that have come, a lot of these guys are hurting. And when you become, to become a pro athlete in a United States, anything, you know, football or baseball or golf, whatever, part of it is his extreme level of pride. And these guys just don't ask for help. But you hear players so much these days say, and I hear it all the time, "We're a family." You know, mostly it's a lot of times to fans or media say, you know, "You don't understand this."
Yeah, we're a family. You're
well,
not
you know,
a part
you know
of
what?
It, right.
If you're a family, help out your family. And that was sort of the inspiration for writing the book. Because the Oscar Robertson suit, people have heard, obviously have heard Oscar Robertson. And some people in basketball have heard of the Oscar
of
Robertson
course, yeah.
suit. They don't realize what these guys did. It was Oscar who was head of the Players Association, which in itself was extraordinary. In the mid-60s, a black man to be leading an American labor association, negotiating, obviously, with all right corporate America. And so, you know, the background of it essentially is the NFL with the AFL. So the NFL pulls a backdoor trick with the Louisiana Senator Huey Long, who Louisiana politics, no offense to Chicago, is probably more corrupt even than Chicago has ever been, or New Jersey. And so the AFL comes along in mid-60s, whenever it was. In fact, I remember as in New York at the time going to New York Titans games at the Polo Grounds.
Right.
So I know the history myself, and it was pretty brutal. But the players now, for the first time, have some leverage because they can play off the ABA. You know, if I'm going to not—
They could play in the NFL or play in the AFL, right.
Right. So the NFL realizes that this is going to hurt negotiations because I can't do what Red Auerbach did with John Havlicek and just tell him take it or leave it. And the essence of that was the baseball reserve clause, which,
right.
again, another anti-constitutional measure which protected baseball in the early 1900s.
Because up to this point, with the NFL, with basketball, with baseball even, I mean, there was the suit in baseball as well. If you were drafted by a team— Your rights. They could trade you, but there was no free agency. You couldn't say my contract's up. It was perpetuity.
Absolutely right, and it's a word. Your rights were owned by that team. You were essentially owned. I mean, Kurt Flood famously said, "No matter what you make, if you're owned by someone, you're a slave." You know, that was offensive at the time. Although Kurt Flood eventually won his suit and is more famous, but these basketball players did this before Kurt Flood. But you know, just briefly to go back to the AFL thing. So the NFL cuts a deal with Huey Long, says, if you bring me a franchise to Louisiana, the New Orleans Saints, I'll subvert the antitrust laws of the country and allow this merger. And effectively he does. And that's how the AFL and the NFL got together and eliminated the bargaining power for the players. So now the ABA comes along in 1967, and the NBA says they're going to do the same thing. Well, the NBA players, now led by Oscar Robertson, and I go back into that history too.
Yeah, right.
It's essentially a history of the NBA from 57 to 75. And to me, what's significant of that is not only the famous players, you know, Wilt and Russell and Cousy, Oscar Robertson, Dave, you know, Jerry West, all these tremendous Hall of Famers, Elgin Baylor, but it's never discussed anymore. It's essentially, I always look at it that the ESPN nature of sports. They started in 79, and they have no film before that. So there's nothing that existed.
That's so interesting. You're absolutely right. I mean, you think of these great players and what they did to really set the table for the players of today. It's astounding. Sam Smith in studio. The book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. Let's take a break. We come back. Let's talk about the ABA and the NBA because, in effect, like the AFL and the NFL, it gave players at least a little bit of leeway to leave a team and go back. But again, it caused trouble in the sense that mergers and there was harbingers of things to come. Sam Smith, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. My guest tonight, Sam Smith, longtime basketball writer, one of my faves, author of The Jordan Rules, which is one of the best books ever written about Chicago sports. His new book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. All of the players that we know today, whether it be Russell Westbrook or LeBron James or Steph Curry, they really owe all of their financial success to players like Oscar Robertson and the players that essentially had to sue the NBA to start free agency. That at the core, it sounds simple. Right. But it's not, because at the time, this is a different league. Athletes are treated differently. We talked about ownership rights in perpetuity. They were fighting tooth and nail, the NBA, the ABA, everyone involved, to make sure that this kind of thing did not happen.
Well, absolutely. And the interesting thing is just because something has happened now, it doesn't mean it was inevitable. You know, so just because the NBA players have these abilities in free agency, it could have been like the NFL players, who really don't have the kind of free agency because they didn't have the union structure, and they weren't able to fight the league or didn't fight the league. And so these guaranteed contracts, that all these elements that have made the NBA players the most prosperous in all of sports, didn't necessarily have to occur. So what happened with this group of players, Oscar Robertson leading this union back in the mid-60s, when the NBA, and the ABA has a grand history. I mean, it basically was started by a bunch of businessmen trying to get into the NBA. And that's why they picked a lot of these southern markets, Memphis, they were in.
They were looking to be merged,
right?
Essentially.
They came
right
in wanting to be merged to enhance their value. And if you remember back then, a lot of people aren't old enough like me to remember that, but remembering back then, the NBA was a very conservative league. Even though you had the great Celtics fast breaks in the 60s, it sort of degenerated in the 70s to a slower game. And so the ABA comes along as this sort of outlaw league, yeah, but rival league. And really, if you look back to the great things about the NBA now, dunking and 3 points and everything now, that all element, it came out of the ABA because it was sort of an essence of, it was black basketball, it was street basketball, it was combining all these elements of style that the more corporate NBA was reluctant to embrace. And so the ABA sort of almost pushed that on it, but they were not funded like the NBA. So the NBA sort of eventually was able to wear them out. But these players came along because there was no free agency. In effect, there was this reserve clause, which was the history of baseball, which started in the late 19th century, where a certain number, I think it was 5 or 6 players, were allowed to be reserved for that team. That became known as the reserve clause, and the Supreme Court inappropriately accepted that in the early 20th century ruling. So now baseball, you know, didn't have the antitrust laws to deal with. So the other leagues did. And so the NBA players, led by Robertson and what I call these Robertson 14, it was essentially the player reps from all the teams, some big names, some not, Bill Bradley and Chet Walker with Chicago, and about lesser guys, Mel Counts and Tom Mascheri, Don Kojus, who was an original Bull in the 60s, was out in San Diego, I think, that time. And so these guys all go to Congress to file
to say this is antitrust.
And the difference was and there's great stories in that too. They get to the committee, and it's Sam Ervin, who goes on to much greater fame in the Watergate committee as you know, the key prosecutor. But he basically, rather than what happened with the NFL owners, the NBA owners come in and say, well, we want, you know, we want you to ignore the antitrust laws in effect. And he said, well, you know what? If we'll do that, if you're asking us to do that, I think what we should do is have the government run all sports. And that was, you know, your holy crap moment for sports all of a sudden. Like, whoa, no, we don't want that.
Right.
Well, he said, well, if you're asking us to overturn the antitrust laws of the country, we have to have a say in this. So now the NBA players, Oscar and these guys, are finally on strong ground. They go into court. They win in court. They're in Congress. And now the NBA is starting to drop these cases. So, you know, they're starting to win. But what happens when you win and you beat your boss is ramifications for
yeah.
that. You know, Oscar Robertson, who is one of the great minds in the history of the game, brilliant player. I mean, maybe coincidence or not, because he is, I know Oscar a long time, he is prickly to deal with. But, you know, for that guy never to get an offer to be a coach or general manager or a position with any
And
team,
even having a television job that at one point the NBA says,
right.
Why is this guy on TV? He doesn't like the league. Essentially, the NBA went out of their way to make sure that Oscar Robertson didn't have any association with the league.
You know, you can't prove blackballing right. and all, but Chet Walker, his last season in Chicago was 75 when they almost went to the – they lost to Golden State, and Golden State went on to sweep Washington for the title. He averaged 19.6 that season and didn't get another offer the next season. He, of course, that was the end of the suit at that time, and it was also pretty clear that, you know, they were into settlement. That was in 75. And so things – there. Obviously not everybody. Bill Bradley was one of the plaintiffs, and he did fairly well after yeah. that. He became a U.S. senator.
Well, I'm interested because – a lot of people who are NBA fans or sports fans, they'll say, well, you know what, these guys now, well, they knew what they were getting into, or I don't have too much sympathy for these players because they make millions and millions of dollars. But when you look specifically, and it's in this book, Hard Labor, when you look at what these players had to endure in a different time in the 60s, the racial inequality, financial inequality, the idea that they weren't even considered talent. At a certain point, I mean, they were considered cattle in the way that the owners were like, this person plays this position. But right. there's some great stories in the book of people who came out of college in the first round and first pick overall that because of whatever situation, they didn't fit in with the team. And that was it. That was their career
right.
because they didn't have the ability anymore to jump around or hadn't even started yet. But my point being that to look back at the stories that preceded Oscar Robertson and the 14 going to Congress, going to the courts, you can understand why.
Well, what resonates a lot to me is that what these guys went through, they were essentially, I know people look at it like pro athletes and, you know, they're spoiled. And relatively, it was in that era. They averaged $20,000 salary, and the average American worker salary was like $4,000 or $5,000. So they were paid more. The gap, obviously, like in the rest of our society now, has expanded exponentially, you know, the 1% and all that. You know, they were sort of considered ultimate. But in a sense, they were freedom fighters of their era because, I mean, consider the, you know, there's so many instances. Elgin Baylor sat out a regular season game. Consider these things going on in this era. We always say that. Well, could you imagine if this was this and Twitter with all this stuff? He sat out a regular season game because back then, to be fair, the NBA economics weren't great. It wasn't like, you know, New York or Boston even was selling out. They weren't. Hockey was more popular. And in fact, the NBA was born by the hockey owners just wanting to get additional dates for their arenas.
Right.
And that's how the NBA came in. And I go back and take a lot of history of the league because I really enjoyed the history of the league. But so they played at so-called neutral sites. Like the Bulls used to do, they would play in Evansville because Jerry Sloan was popular down there. They figured they'd sell a few extra seats. And so they were playing in a game in North Carolina, and Elgin couldn't eat in the restaurant or stay in the hotel with the other players. So he said, well, I can't do that. I'm not playing in the game, and didn't. It was a great Celtic story in the book I tell where they went back to Kentucky on a trip, you know, with Cliff Hagan. They were doing his jersey, and Adolph Rupp never allowed, you know, black players. So they went home. And there was one barnstorming thing where in the preseason, these guys used to play 20 games in 20 days straight. You know, you hear guys now moaning about back-to-backs and stuff. And so they went to Indiana, and southern Indiana, and they got a little parade with the mayor when they came in, the NBA team, key to the city and all. And then they couldn't eat in the local restaurants. So they go to the mayor's house at night and brought them back the key to the city. And You know, so these guys went through such racial humiliation in part of this, even though they were, you know, some of the greatest athletes in the history of the game.
And to think that we haven't even talked about some of the strange stories, and we'll do this after the news, but the strange stories of, I guess you call it recruiting, where kids think they're going to certain schools and they're kidnapped.
Yeah,
in a way to go.
Chet Walker,
yeah, I want to get to that. Sam Smith in studio with me. His new book, Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. It's out now. One of the great Chicago sports writers, also the author of The Jordan Rules. We'll take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. Sam Smith at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Sam Smith in studio with me, the longtime Chicago sports writer, award winner, the author of one of the greatest Chicago sports books of all time, The Jordan Rules. He's got a new one. It's called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. In it, he talks about Oscar Robertson and his suit to essentially start free agency for the NBA and to really question and challenge a merger between the NBA and the ABA back in the 60s, 1970. It is a fascinating look at not just the politics and what it takes, labor inequality, all the things that are even referenced with the title, but the history of what these players had to endure. Right before the break, we talked about, it's amazing, these kids at 18 years old, essentially picking a school to go to, and then getting kidnapped and brought to a different school.
Yeah.
And they had to go along with it.
We think if you heard that kind of story now, you would say, well, that can't be.
And there'd be authorities involved. Yeah, that can't be, right?
Chet Walker told me this story. Chet was from Michigan. His mother was picking cotton in Mississippi and Great Migration. In the 40s, they come up to Michigan, and he becomes a good player, and he's recruited to go to Nebraska, and that's where he's going to go. Actually, it was Fred Hoiberg's grandfather was the coach there at the time.
Oh, wow.
Fred later told me this story as well. It was in the book, too. And so Chet, a friend, offers to drive him to Nebraska. Now he ends up basically in Illinois at Bradley. And so, you know, and they say, well, this is where you're going to school. And he said, and they had a couple of these things, was he had an incident where he was betting pennies and they put him in jail or something for gambling. We know the racial treatment of blacks in this country has been, you know, a great sin. But, you know, as he said, look, you know, black kids were getting hung if you went to the wrong place. So it's the middle of the night, and he ends up being spirited off to Bradley, and they say, this is where you're playing.
This is where you're going. You said, well, so I'm supposed to go to Nebraska. Playing here.
So he tells me this story, and I don't really half believe it. And I'm sort of questioning. I'm trying to figure out how I could think. And then I hear almost an identical story from Joe Caldwell, who is another one of the plaintiffs in the suit, ends up at Arizona State. He was supposed to be going to UCLA. A guy got him. He was, you know, the night, say, hey, you want to go to a party, and ends up at Arizona State and said, this is where you go in the school. And these kids, you know, this is a time where black kids are being hung for who knows, you know, any number of things. And so these incredible things are going on in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. It's
unbelievable. And that's at the college level. Then you talk about the NBA level. You talked about the stories earlier about, you know, the stars, Lenny Wilkins. This idea that you could play and be a star for these teams, for an NBA, for a league, and yet they won't let you go into the restaurant.
Well, Lenny's is an amazing story.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Hall of Famer as a coach and a player, and he's starting. He's an all-star for the St. Louis Hawks. And I remember there was two sort of border cities. You know, they're still fighting the Civil War in a lot of places, and St. Louis and Cincinnati were in the NBA then. And that's, you know, part of Oscar's issue. And, you know, playing his career in Cincinnati and basically eventually being run out. The team ended up moving. So Lenny is starting for the St. Louis Hawks and Bob Pettit, Cliff Hagan, you know, the last actually with
big stars,
the only team to break the Celtics winning streak there with Bill Russell, because Russell got hurt that one year. But a great team and, you know, potential dynasty type team. And so he was a starter, and the restaurant across the street had the pictures on you know, big glass pictures, big like the WGN studios here on Michigan Avenue. And, you know, of Hagan and Pettit and all the starters, including Lenny. But he couldn't eat in that restaurant because he's black. And these guys couldn't barely say anything. You know, Oscar Robertson's wife marched at Selma and had to escape, you know, in a pickup truck overnight, you know, being chased out of town and, you know, couldn't go. He when his daughter was born, he couldn't go be with his wife because that wasn't allowed. You know, you couldn't have a, you know, a player couldn't leave a team. You know, he said, well, even Oscar Robertson. Oscar told me, and that was an amazing thing. You know, all these guys had to work the off season. He worked summers for Pepsi. Remember, you seen the Pepsi guys with the pinstripe Pepsi? You know, that was Oscar Robertson in the summer going around working for Pepsi.
With the time and the age of the civil rights movement and what was happening in the country in the late 60s, were the African-American basketball players, the NBA and the ABA, were they aware that this was unacceptable? I mean, is this really what started the idea of the suit and free agency and everything, that this is really about civil rights? The idea that you can't have this kind of league where these white owners essentially own these basketball players?
Well, they didn't look at it as strictly a civil right. They were part of a civil rights movement that nobody knew they were part of the civil rights movement, because the notion was, well, they're professional athletes. They're spoiled. Look at all the money they make. You know, and just because Wilt and Russell are making $100,000, that was the big thing then. Wilt and Russell made $100,000. Well, the average salary was $20,000. And when the suit started, the average salary, I think, was $18,000. And when the suit ended, the average salary was $90,000. So they had, you know, because of the leverage they gained with the ABA, they were able to work themselves up. You know, they became, you know, civil rights pioneers in effect, but they were pioneers for their sport.
Right.
They were sort of alongside the civil rights movement. You know, you can't quite compare them with what was going on, you know, in Detroit, you know, and Martin Luther King and everything, you know, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. But the point is, for NBA players, they were those pioneers for this generation of NBA players. This generation of NBA players would not live as they did if not for the sacrifices these guys took while becoming great players and then going through these tremendous indignities all the time. You know, roommates, the conditions they travel in. Tommy Heinsohn told me this story. There was no team buses then. You'd get ridden to the arena. Literally now, when the hotel's across the street, they take a bus to the arena. It's across the street.
Really. Right?
I've seen this all the time. The notion, well, they're rich and all.
They can't be on the street. They can't be on the sidewalk, Sam. Come
but
on.
They guys would pile into a cab to get to the arena. So then they get reimbursed by the coach, you know, when they got to the arena. And have Heinsohn told me the story about, you know, they got four guys in. They got there, it was $350, and they went to Red and said, you know, it cost $350. Red said, I'm in the same hotel. It cost me $325. That's all you're getting.
And that you pick and up that was, the rest, right?
Right. And that was it. That was there was nothing you could do about it. There was you know, there's no leverage to this. And so these guys, you know, on a lot of issues related to, you know, their careers, but more, you know, the freedom of any American worker to say, look, I don't like my situation. Can I do something else? And these guys didn't have that.
When you think of the NBA today, and you think of all the players and free agency, we just saw this past year, the major teams, they're building these super teams. People can go where they want to go. There's a lot happening. The players, it's definitely a players' league.
Which is good.
Do they look back when you talk to these players, and do they recognize the sacrifices that were made by their...
Not at all. Zero. Now, to their credit, and I give them credit, they did in the last labor agreement, they included a provision for medical payments. But, you know, most of the guys who played in that era are on Medicare now, you know. So, you know, it helps with supplementals. They're shocked. They have no idea. But it's like any kids growing up in this era. You know, like I said, and I go back to that ESPN example, just because of the way they came to dominate sports and – Nobody talks about, you know, that era and those players. They've heard of them. Everybody's heard of their names, but they've never seen them because there's, you know, there's essentially no film on it and no clips. And, you know, occasionally there'll be a documentary.
Yeah.
But when I tell players about this, in fact, Chet Walker lives in L.A. And he told me that he ran into Jamal Crawford, who used to be with the Bulls, was playing with the Clippers last year. Chet has the second highest scoring game in the history of the Bulls franchise. Got a 56-point game. He was a great player with the Bulls. He's in the Hall of Fame. And so he met Jamal and he introduced himself. And he says, you know, I used to play for the Bulls. He said, really? I mean, Jamal, who's a bright guy, one of the more knowledgeable guys, had never heard of Chet Walker, you know, who was...
And he played on the same team in the
same
city,
franchise,
right?
And... Because Jamal says to him, Chet was telling me the story, he said, Jamal says to him, well, I thought I was the only other guy who got 50 points. You mean you got 50 points? He said, well, yeah, I got 56 one time. And so he scored one. And that's an example. But, you know, look, Americans are not good on history. And so The difference is with NBA players is they make a point to say that this is their history as part of a family. And that's always the thing because I hear it all the time from players when you're around media and around, and I'll say, well, you don't understand because, you know, we're part of this special fraternity. Mm-hmm. But they don't understand. And that's fine. You know, that's not unusual. But at the same time, you're in a position that you really can do something for the client. You know, most of these guys are dying, you know, and many of them who I've spent time with, and they don't like me to mention their names, that I'm not going to. But different guys who I visited when I was doing the book, and that was the great thing for me. I was able to, you know, spend a year or more going around seeing these guys and spending a day with them or whatever. And some of them are living in houses they've been living in for 40 or 50 years. And, you know, they're doing okay. Some, you know, but look, things have gotten so great. Can't you do something to say, you know,
put a fund together.
It wouldn't take much. I mean, in some cases, it's really awful. There are guys living in assisted living places that, you know, need. And I've heard. I know some of these guys who they are need, you know, just sundries just to get through. And so
toothpaste.
Right. And you know, there are groups. The NBA has funds to help. There's an ABA group out of Indianapolis that has funds to help. But there's just so much money now in the NBA. And so much spread around. And one guy I'd like to see do more, because he has tried, Chris Paul, who's now president of the Players Association, he has a recognition of history and appreciation. He doesn't know a lot of it. But when he hears about it, I can see that he's always sympathetic to it. And I'm kind of hoping that he will. And that's why I did this book, basically. Yeah. Read the book. There's appeals in there a couple of times to say, look, help him out. Do the right thing.
Do the right thing.
Do something.
Yeah, that's right.
Just help them out. Just do something.
When you think back to that, because we're coming up 50 years here, when you think back to that era, the era right before, and actually when you think about the years between 1970 and 1976 where this suit was happening and the NBA and the ABA were merging or about to merge, when you think about the owners of the NBA and people who are management, do they look back at that time as one of fond memories? Or do they look back and say it was a rocky, tumultuous time for the NBA? No, that was terrible for the history. Because you make the point that it could have gone one way or the other. There were some players that were like, I don't want to be involved with this suit. This is bad news for our league.
Well,
but it
scary.
Actually turned out to be huge for the league.
Well, it's scary because, you know, the threats were you're going to lose your job, you know, because you had nowhere to go. You know, there was one league, and if we're able to kill the other league and – you know, you saw what happened, like the football players who broke the strike line. You know, they wouldn't let them come back and play, you know, most of them basically. So, you know, that I mean, obviously, you know, Oscar and, you know, other these guys weren't going to be, you know, they weren't going to lose their jobs. But a lot of, you know, mid-level guys, like some of the guys on the suit, like a Mel Counts or a Tom Mascheri, you know, Jeff Mullins, whatever, you know, who knows? I mean, the league can go on fine. You know, the truth is, look, Michael Jordan retired. And the league is more profitable than ever was. So institutions always transcend individuals. So everybody sort of knew, you know, everybody understand that on some level. But at the same time, they said, look, we should not only stand up for each other. But the point was not a single one of them, and they all knew it at the time, would not benefit from what they did. Yeah. That the free agency that they got in 1976 would not really begin to come into effect until the late 70s, early 80s. And all of them would be out of basketball in it. So they knew at the time that they were standing up for a personal risk that not a single one of them stood a chance of benefiting from. But they knew it was the right thing to do, and it was right for their game. And they said it would make the league stronger, and it did, and always has.
It's an inspiring story. The book is called Hard Labor, The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. The author is the author of one of the greatest Chicago sports books, Jordan Rules. Sam Smith, who covers the Bulls for Bulls.com, longtime Chicago Tribune columnist. Sam, great to see you, and thank you so much for being my guest at the Big Table, and thanks for writing the book.
It was great. Thanks a lot for having me.
Good to catch up with Sam Smith. Talk about his new book, Hard Labor. Jordan Rules, one of my favorites, as Pete said earlier tonight. It's always troubling when people say, what's your favorite book? And it turns out to be a sports book. Superior Running Backs of the 80s? But it's true. I am surprised that Jordan rules would never be it would be a good one book, one Chicago entry. Right? Doesn't feel like, I remember I was doing book club at a different station where we'd have everyone read it and we'd have guests on. It was part of it. We tried. It was convoluted. It never worked because no one read anything. Not even us, you know. But 1 month of the book club that we did, I did Jordan rules because I was like, that's great. And Sam came on and it was awesome. I'm just like, yeah, it's really fun to read because it's what I love this book because of the issues and the themes and the narratives that are in here and how it kind of equates to and gives a parallel to what's happening today. But it's not my generation of NBA. You know, I feel like the first time I was even aware there was an NBA was Reggie Theus, and maybe Reggie Theus, then Michael Jordan. Then you had a feel where you're like, oh, well, once they start putting players on posters, you know, when you start getting a Michael Jordan poster, even the young, just because he could rim rattle, you know, rattle the rim and you put that on your door. That's who I came of age on. It's so cliche. I came of age on Michael Jordan. I mean, come on. But it's true. I mean, there was no bigger. It's kind of what annoys me about the Bulls right now. To be 3-19, you're like, when you're good, when a Bulls basketball team is good, and people may think maybe the best. You saw it with Derrick Rose. This town goes red. It goes Bulls red.
Yeah, I was. My wife was telling me that she was in Nike Town last week. And
good place to be.
And she was, you know, there's tons of basketball stuff. It's all Golden State Warriors. That's, yeah. You know, it's not the Bulls. There's like hardly any Bulls stuff. They have Bulls things, but it's all Golden State Warriors and, you know, LeBron James and things like that. But yeah, no, but like Bulls are third in the home, yeah. Their home market.
So when you read the story of Jordan rules, when you get a chance and you lived it, and we all lived it in Chicago to watch those amazing games, even the games for the before the Bulls won championships when we were losing to the Pistons, and to get the behind-the-scenes story. It's even before social media and the internet, so there's not this, you know, there's no Instagram flame wars. Or every night Sports Center, where a source tells you what happened with LeBron James every night. I mean, It kind of becomes overwhelming. There was some story, I can't remember what it was. It was some story I read today that I was like, how do they know that? And there's just something where it's like, did you know that LeBron James loves chicken nuggets? Like it was something that was just like, what? I just passed on. I was like, I don't even know how. And all of that stuff is in Jordan rules. Like what the players thought of Jordan, what Jordan secretly said behind the scenes, what the plane was like. Like all the kind of stuff that you want to know about it that wasn't available in 1988 or 89 or whatever it was. So, good stuff. Good stuff, Hard Labor. Check it out. The Battle That Birthed the Billion-Dollar NBA. Earlier in the night when I was introducing it, I said Oscar Robertson, but I kind of went Oscar Robinson. It sounded like Robinson. And a texter had, did you mean Robertson? Called me out. It's part of this job sometimes where you're like, all right. I know I sound like the non-sports fan doing sports. There's this guy, Oscar Robinson. Really good. I guess he was really good, Pete. He's a really good player. We're going to continue with our thread. I'm reading a ton of sports books right now. I should get this, see if we find the author of Superior Running Backs of the 80s. But Terry Bors. Terry Bors, Bors and Bernstein, longtime sports radio host and columnist here in Chicago. He's written a new book about his career. He'll be on the show on Thursday. Thank you, Rob. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we're going to play The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. Our longtime friend and panelist, Kristen Toomey, will be here. Have some fun. We'll complain about the worst things for prizes. Prizes tonight look like they're going to be fun. We've got sweets and pizza, as it should be. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. But right now, you know, there's been a lot made about the future of driverless technology. But the truth of the matter is that we might want to take the word future out of it because it's here. More and more private companies, including Tesla and Uber, have announced their intentions to move driverless technology, cars and trucks, on the road, put them on the road in the short term. So instead of debating the merits or whining about the good old days, we should embrace it. And more importantly, plan for it. What do municipalities and governments need to do to prepare for an influx of autonomous vehicles? And what do we need to know as drivers who are going to share the road? The Metropolitan Planning Council is all over this as we continue our series, How to Improve Blank. Blank is transportation and driverless technology for tonight. And we welcome MPC's Director of Transportation, Audrey Wenink, to the program tonight. Audrey, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. I mean, this is a great topic to talk about. Obviously, I've heard... It's funny because in my doctor's office, there was a Time magazine that said something to the effect of, you know, driverless technology, will you drive, blah, blah, blah. And I recognize it's been sitting there for a long time. Like, I looked at the date, it was a long time. But it does seem to push us in this way that says, it's in the future, it's the future, it's the future, but the future is now.
Right. There's a lot of hype about autonomous vehicles. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of expectations. But I don't think we want to pin all our hopes on them that they're going to solve all of our transportation problems.
Yeah, right. Let's start there. I mean, the goal is it's mainly a private sector project to put driverless technology on the roads. This helps for trucks and for cars and limits the amount of money that needs to be put into workforce and things of that nature. But this is coming from companies that want to push this technology and put it on the roads.
Sure. I mean, automotive manufacturers, Ford, GM, Tesla, they're all integrating this into their vehicle design. And these cars they're out there right now. Some cars that you don't have to even touch the steering wheel. You just have to be attentive to take control back if something goes wrong. And then there's a lot of features like automatic braking and automated parking and things like that. So some of those features are out there already.
Right, right. And when I talk about autonomous vehicles and even driverless technology, I mean, what comes to mind is the idea that the cars that we see right here in our showcase studio right now that are whizzing by on Michigan Avenue, they'll be without a human being at the helm. Is that the pure way to understand driverless technology?
Well, there's five levels of autonomous vehicles as defined by the federal government. And so, you know, levels one and two, people are in the car, three people are in the car and have less and less of a role. Only level five has nobody in the car, and it's not built from the ground up to never have anyone ever use it. That's the goal ultimately, to make transportation less expensive and reduce the labor costs and make transportation kind of foolproof, you know, safe, like can't get into accidents. And that is a potential really big benefit. Safety is a huge problem with transportation right now. But there's pros and cons.
Well, let's get into the municipality side of this, because for us to get to a level four or a level five or even a three, and, you know, when you talk about autonomous vehicles, let's talk about regulation, because I would assume that the minute that there would be any car from the private sector that would be on the road in any of those levels, it would have to go through City Hall. It'd have to get sign off from if not the city government, the state government, the federal government. Is that not the case?
Yeah, right now, it depends what state you're in. But right now, I mean, the city doesn't have any policies about autonomous vehicles. Some cities have established policy frameworks, like Portland, Oregon has established its Safe Autonomous Vehicles Initiative, where they're actually permitting and partnering with the vehicle manufacturers to test them so that they get the data and they're kind of understanding what is happening in the testing arena. Arizona is letting it be kind of a free-for-all, so it's varying.
Interesting.
In Chicago, it's not a policy framework established yet.
Well, we were kind of talking about it when we were setting the segment up, but the concept of two ways to kind of go about driverless technology, one being let the private sector have at the roads, do whatever they can, and they want to do this. That's, you know, without regulation, to come in and essentially get these products into the hands of consumers. But the other is to tell those manufacturers, yes, there's going to be a place for driverless technology in the city, but this is what we expect. This is what we want. This is what kind of city that you're working in. there needs to be there needs to be compliance.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as you see, I mean, right there, you just mentioned Portland and Arizona. They're both taking two different approaches to this same topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to step back and realize vehicles are part of the transportation system. They're only one part of it. Transit is huge in this region. There are 2 million people a day that ride transit in the Chicago region. When you look at the roads, and we're here in the studio and we're looking out on Michigan Avenue, and, you know, the road, Michigan Avenue, has tons of buses. It has 100 buses an hour that run on it. There's sidewalks. There's bicycles going down the street. So our quote-unquote right-of-way, our streets serve many functions. And so we need to respect that in a very complex city like this and determine what's good for the city. And what do we want? We want active, healthy citizens. We want clean air, so we want environmentally friendly transportation. We want safe transportation. The city put out a Vision Zero plan. We don't want people dying in car crashes, so that is a benefit of autonomous vehicles. We want economic opportunity. So we want all these good things, and we need to figure out how can autonomous vehicles provide those benefits and not provide negatives that we could avoid.
It's so interesting to me because a lot of this has to do with what eventually would be machine learning. And, you know, because I was thinking about it in my head, but, you know, if you've ever been Friday afternoon or evening on a road like Western or Ashland in the city of Chicago, a two-lane, four-lane highway, but at the same time a bus is there or someone double parks to jump into a place, and everyone has to veer to the left or start to essentially improvise. What happens when the machine has to be in that situation? They're not going to improvise. They're going to stop, and there's going to be a lot of frustration around the fact that driving in Chicago or other big cities, as we know it, is an ebb and flow. It is making audibles and improvising in the moment and sharing the road with machines that won't be able to do that. I could see being very frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a huge transition. There's going to be a long period where there will be some autonomous vehicles and there'll be other vehicles on the road. Most people own their cars an average of 10, 12 years. So there's going to be a huge transition period. There are a lot of things that are very hard for autonomous vehicles to learn, like how to deal with pedestrians and unpredictable movements. And there's a lot of etiquette that goes into driving that people don't think about. Like when you're crossing a street, you make eye contact with the driver. And I've read that it's very hard to figure out how to deal with these complex movements in urban intersections for vehicles to understand what people are going to do. And we really want to prioritize transportation for pedestrians and bikes. That's what we've done in this city in recent years. We've made priority bus lanes. We've got bike lanes. We are increasing pedestrian crosswalks. We want active, healthy people with good social interaction. And that's, you know, a good balanced transportation system. And so we don't want to have autonomous vehicles just sort of take over and have it become a city without people.
Right.
If you Google autonomous vehicle images, you're going to find most of the pictures have cars with little circles around them. And there are no pedestrians or bikes or people anywhere in the images. That's sort of this futuristic vision.
Yeah. So Audrey Wenink is in studio. She's the Metropolitan Planning Council's Director of Transportation. We're talking about, we do this time to time on the download, do our segment, How to Improve Blank. Tonight we're talking about transportation and autonomous vehicles and driverless technology. There's two parts of this. Obviously, how municipalities prepare for this when it comes to regulation and making sure the private sector works for them. But the other part, of course, we're talking about is safety and what is going to happen when autonomous vehicles and robots are essentially driving, next to you on Lower Wacker Drive. All right, so let's go back to the regulation part because, and I know this is not popular right now because regulation, especially with the administration that's in Washington, that's a bad word, regulation. But is there a way to think about it? And I know these private companies are lobbied up and they're not the kind of companies that are going to say, yes, this sounds like a great idea. But is there a way to regulate this so that there can be financial opportunity for taxpayers that this technology is coming onto the roads, meaning taxes, policies around, fees, what's happening essentially with ride shares?
Yeah, well, I mean, rideshare was a great example of wanting to establish policies that are good for society. So rideshare came into the region. It wasn't really well regulated. The number of cars got very, very high, and we've seen a lot of increased congestion. There's been some studies about that. And we also have seen diversion from transit. And transit is really important to this region. It's a real priority. We can't function without transit. And they, took some of the money from rideshare and put it towards transit maintenance, which we need a lot of funding for transit. You've probably heard about all the fare increases.
Right.
There's some real, we're living in the moment today, and we need to maintain the system that we have as well as thinking about the future.
But I mean, to me, I know that that there's those companies that are investing in this technology. They're not going to be like, yeah, I think there should be a surcharge on top of this.
No.
They're just not going to do that. But is that something that, as municipalities look at their budgets and their bottom lines and everything is tight, can it possibly be a revenue source as well?
Well, the cities manage the right-of-way. The cities operate the streets. And the state DOTs manage the highways. And so I think what is more likely is establishing at least early, a permitting process where you're doing some kind of testing and permitting. You could charge for permitting and allow a company to do some type of pilot. And then you require them to give you the data from the pilot. And so then you're kind of learning together and making sure that what you're doing is working for the region.
When we talk about driverless technology, a lot of it, might be the big trucks that hit the expressways and the interstates in this country to essentially, make the labor force less inexpensive for those companies. But when we talk about consumers who might be able to use this instead of what they do now, whether they're taking the metro or possibly mass transit in the city, they might jump in an Uber or rideshare in that case. Who is this directly competing with? Who's at risk of losing ridership and opportunity and cost? Is it the Metro train? Is it the CTA train? Who stands to lose from autonomous vehicles hitting the streets of Chicago?
Well, autonomous vehicles, they do have the potential to siphon off some ridership from transit, but there's definitely a limit because cars are cars. If you look at a road full of cars, and then you look at a road full of autonomous cars,
it looks the same. Right.
And so there's only so much space in the roads, so that you're going to hit capacity. Maybe you're going to be able to fit 20% more cars in the road. They're going to be able to go, 2 inches apart, and you won't have as many weaving patterns and such. So you maybe can fit a few more, but there's no way you're going to have everyone change to being in a car. I mean, Metra has calculated that if you shut down Metra, you would need to build 27 lanes of roadway to accommodate all the people that are. I mean, so our city transit's not going anywhere.
Right.
Our city is built on transit. Autonomous vehicles will provide another option, but it's also very important that we don't allow them to become a very elite option and have even more social division and be only for the rich people.
Right. Equity. I can see that. I was going to ask the same question about whether or not this is just going to be a new version of automatic or a stick shift. is it going to be automatic or autonomous? That what's going to happen with when you go to a car dealer? You say, I'll take the driverless technology over, the ability to drive.
I think everything's going to migrate to autonomous. You'll hear from Lyft and Uber that pretty soon on your app, you'll be able to pick not only, Lyft Line or Uber Pool, but you'll be able to pick Uber autonomous. You'll get like choices and you'll know what you're choosing at least when they enter the market like that. But the Metropolitan Planning Council is very concerned about equity. It's a big focus. We're a nonprofit and we think about the region as a whole. Equity is one of our major emphasis areas. And we're very concerned that autonomous vehicles and any transportation solution increase equity and increase access for people and not only increase it for a few people and make it worse for everybody else.
Well, as we look at Michigan Avenue as a test study, as we see the buses go flying by here as we're having this conversation, we also see a lot of taxis. We see ride shares up and down here. I mean, there has to be some question about workforce and what this means for people having jobs in the transportation industry with this kind of technology here and ready to be implemented.
Right. I'll use the overused word of disruptor, right? This is a very big disruption. This is not only a major, autonomous vehicles will not only majorly impact transportation, but will impact the insurance industry, will impact, you know, any driver, will impact a full range of areas. And there's a very large amount of concern about all the employment. I mean, Lyft and Uber have made a big deal about creating a lot of jobs, but within a few years, they hope to be autonomous and all those jobs would go away. In terms of transit, there is the possibility that transit workers could shift to more of a customer service orientation where they wouldn't be operating the vehicles, but they would be staffing the transit system in a different way. So I think we need to be open-minded and flexible and think about transportation as a service and how do we continue to make it work better for people, and employment is certainly part of the picture.
My last question to you is just as the city and the state and the federal government has always been at the forefront of infrastructure when it comes to transportation, whether it be building the L or metro or even doing refurbishing or renovations, should they be in this game? Should the city of Chicago be looking at buying autonomous vehicles and finding a way to get involved in this technology that's about to hit the streets?
I think it's a little early to say that, you know, a large public investment in owning vehicles is the right thing to do right now. But a lot of urban planners believe that the best scenario is that autonomous vehicles be a shared fleet and not privately owned. Hmm. So a shared fleet and electric so that they're very efficient and autonomous. That way you'd have ultimately fewer vehicles because everyone would be sharing them. There'd be less parking. All that parking could be used for public space. So those are the positives that some people see.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're on to something, right? The autonomous car of the month. Audrey Wenink is the Metropolitan Planning Council's Director of Transportation in tonight talking about autonomous vehicles and driverless technology, the world that is right at our doorstep. Audrey, thanks for joining us tonight. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rob. They got me. They hooked me. Although 630 just texted in, and this I totally forgot about this. 612, actually. Enterprise Rent-A-Car canceled their car share program in Chicago earlier this year because of too much theft, fraud, and vandalism. That is true. I remember that story now. So enterprise and rental car companies have already kind of tried this in the idea that you could pick up a rental anywhere and you could switch things around and you could share, which is probably a little bit different, but concept-wise, it's probably the same. If you're just joining us here on 720 WGN, we were just talking about automated vehicles and autonomous vehicles and driverless technology, robots on the road, and how it's here to stay and how car companies... That's what I found interesting about that conversation. The automotive industry, they're the ones pushing it. It's not like it's another tech company that's coming in and pushing another, what am I going to do? The big auto is like, oh, I can't keep up. No, they're the ones saying this is good. This is what we want. They want to transition to that. And there's a lot of reasons why they want to race and put that on the roads before governments can say, oh, hold on. And because once we get attached to something as consumers, we just, as we just saw with ride sharing, is a perfect, that's the blueprint. They put that on the road. We all went, what? Is this my phone? And a guy picks me up. I can go anywhere. Yeah. And then it took forever for the governments to come in. And now if they say we're going to add a dollar to your ride, you and I are like, what? The government? Big bad government? Like everything in between. But in this case, I'm fascinated by the idea that not only will autonomous car, I mean, I was thinking about it before this conversation, just about, okay, well, there are going to be autonomous cars on the road and I'm going to have to compete with them on the road. But as Audrey just mentioned, no, all of the cars are going to be autonomous. Yours that you bought from Honda, Chevy, or Ford included. And so I'm like, oh, I guess it's... And then it becomes, well, maybe the way we know car buying now will change, that you don't go actually buy a physical car. Instead, you go to a Chevy dealer, go to Apple Chevy, and Apple Chevy gives you a subscription. And you get a subscription to Chevy. A monthly subscription. So instead of paying $400 for a lease or for the car payment, you pay $150 or $100, so it's less, so it evens out the economics of it. Yeah. And now you have the ability to pick a car off the lot. And you could drive it for 6 months, but then you come back in and you go, yeah, I want to try the red one.
You know, I want that subscription for $20.99. You know, I think I'm going to have to go in the back and talk to my manager about see what I can do, see if I can shuffle some papers.
That's what will happen. Car dealers will be, salesmen will be haggling over subscription prices. You know what? I'll give you $27.99. That's a final offer. But, I mean, would you do that, Pete? Would you do that? Are you the kind of person that's like, I want my vehicle my way? I want to own this physical product.
No, I mean, living in the city, I went without a car for a long, long time, 15 years probably, where I used iGo at the time. That was the car sharing service that was in Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think I ever used Zipcar, but I was fine with just picking, there'd be times where, like, the person that you're waiting for is late and, cigarette burns and things like that. But I think I'm fine with sharing a car with someone else. I don't need the ownership.
Yeah, and I wonder, would it be like that? When I think of those car sharing services, and they've already been out there because I know that, Zipcar and things like that. That is a different, where it's, you're sharing one vehicle that gets almost like the bike share.
Exactly. It's parked somewhere.
Yeah, like
you
the blue
go.
Bikes, right? Yeah. But what if you took it a step further and you're paying? And I think that Volvo, I was just talking to somebody who was just talking
somebody
about,
here was talking about Volvo.
Yeah. And was saying that, they're moving to a almost like a car program, almost subscription series.
Yeah.
Where every month you get a new car. And I guess the question is, are they hedging their bets upon your bond to the specific vehicle that you own? Like, do I hug my vehicle and I say, this is mine.
Yeah.
Versus, hey, I have transportation whenever I need it. And I have a new one, new thing. Because I feel like I would be the target audience for that. I would like to try that. Like, I would like to be one of the early adapters who's like, you know what? Because I have a 2005 car right now. So that means it's almost curtains. It's time for me to go buy a new car.
Yeah, and that sucks.
Yeah, it's not something – because the process doesn't really intimidate me, and it's fine. And, I know I have the brands and the models and the makes that I like and things like that. But it's a significant investment, and it's one that you got to go in and you have to think about, organize yourself financially as well to say, okay, this is what I got to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And I just wonder at the end of the day that if you're going to organize yourself financially to take on that financial commitment, because with a 2005 car, I stopped paying that car off in 2010 or whatever, in 2012, I think it was. It's 5 years without a payment.
Yeah.
So the thought becomes, if I organize myself to do this kind of thing instead, which I don't think is ready yet. I think mobile subscriptions, what Audrey was talking about, it's almost there, but it's not at the kind of thing where the common man, myself, is being included in this. But, I got to make sure that my car can last until it's time for that to take over. Because I would love that. I think that would be great. Because I'm one that's not I would love to be the guy that every month I turn my car in for new. I'm tidy, I'm organized. I don't have a but at the same time I don't want to deal with no one wants to deal with the maintenance that goes into a car, those kind of things.
I think too. I think if like for people that enjoy cars and like having cars and spend a lot of time and money on cars, I think that. That's somebody, you put a lot of pride into your car. You're going to spend a lot of money. You're going to take care of it. You want that car for a couple of years at least,
right,
And, you know.
I don't know. 630 says very few people want autonomous vehicles. Probably the weirdos in the city might. The ones that don't even own a car. And I don't trust people that don't own a car. That's what 630. What are you talking about?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I didn't have a car for a long time. I didn't, you know, I didn't need it. I had groceries delivered. It was.
It has nothing
to do
with your weirdness. I mean, you are weird, but no. But I mean, you live in the city, and the dynamics, the infrastructure is different. Owning a car, if you do not have a place to park it, is a nightmare. Owning a car in a position when you're competing with mass transit to go here to there at such an alarmingly cheaper rate is nonsense. It's economic nonsense. So I would say you're a weirdo if you do own a car.
When you're in high school and, you know, I was living in the suburbs and, you know, you wanted to take a lady friend out to Pepe's Tacos or something, I'll get on the RTA and meet you. That's not gonna.
But I wonder if that's changed, though. You and I are old men. Like, I bet you right now that half the time people are going on those kind of dates, you want to take your lady, you call an Uber.
Yeah.
Just for the fact that you might probably have a cold one at those Pepe's, you know?
That was, you know, borrowing your parents' car.
Yeah, it's not a thing. I just wonder if I would love, and I'm glad that 630 texts in, because I would love to really suss out, is there a connection with your physical vehicle? You know, like, is that really what we're talking about here? Are you scared of technology in the way that, you know, you're afraid that the autonomous vehicle is going to drive you off a cliff?
Yeah, I'm sure that's a concern.
That's a concern. I'm sure it is. But, you know, are you concerned that, you know, there will be no power or control over your vehicle, meaning you buy a vehicle and you keep it up to snuff and you organize it and you don't want to be in a position where every month you get somebody else's, like you just mentioned, Zipcar, someone's not on time, or cigarette burns, things like that. But I feel that when we talk about the technology industry and the industry that essentially what we're seeing in 2017, the shared industry, whether it's rides or anything down the line, that is being corrected. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that situation you had with Zipcar is being corrected.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they realize, I'm not just going to have the same vehicle. You can't let that vehicle go into disrepair. But what if it was, you still had to drive that vehicle, just like when you lease a car. You lease a car for 2 years or a year. You have to take it back to the dealership.
Yeah, you treat it well.
You treat it well, they check it, and they say, okay, great. There's no extra cost or anything. But I just wonder at the end of the day if that same concept would work with mobility and subscription, where I go back once a month and I get the newest car, or now I'm eligible. The internet tells me I'm eligible for this car. Hey, I get an email or a text on my phone that says, hey, you know what? You've done this, and this, so you're now eligible for this kind of car. Come on in. But the cost doesn't change.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as long as the cost doesn't change, I mean, because it's kind of
Audrey was
saying, you know, there's inequity will be able to come from this, you know, like, oh, I want to rent the fanciest car.
Right. But that might be part of it too, where it's like with rental, just take a page from the rental car industry. There's classifications. So you want this kind of car, it's a certain price. If you want to be in this car, which could get you a Dodge, it's always a Dodge. You know, you get into this area, so maybe it's that kind of thing where you pay more for a select, like, luxury, you know, like midsize sedan, SUV. 630 says people like control. Driving is personal.
Yeah.
No doubt. I guess we're talking about two different things here, because to me, I'm not talking about whether or not I would accept an autonomous vehicle. I've already accepted my fate and your fate that's happening. You're not going to have a choice. So you can put your Honda CR-V up on blocks and work on the engine and treat it like a cool car from the 60s.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, it's all the new cars that you're going to have access to are going to be autonomous in one level or another. As Audrey just said, level one could be it automatically parks for you. It automatically reverses for you. It's just various levels of cruise control.
Right.
And then you get to level 5, which is further down the line where there's just nobody in the car. It's not even built to have a driver.
You know, I want a car where I have to roll down my windows, you know, and not press a button.
Right.
You can't do that anymore.
Absolutely. But I wonder if this is the same argument in some form or another of what people were doing when automatics came along. It used to all be shift, stick shift. You know, and then the automatics came along. That's not driving.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just a newer version of that. Because I guess if you think about this image, the autonomous vehicle is not going to be one that you sit in the back seat and read the paper. I know that's what everybody thinks, that they get in the back like it's a cab. They get strapped in like it's Disneyland. And they enjoy your ride, you know, or a Total Recall, and the robot turns around. That's going to happen, but that's in the future. Right now, it's being designed that there is a human being in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
You can grab the steering wheel, but for all intents and purposes,
you don't need to.
You don't need to. It's being driven for you. What I'm talking about is when you go to buy a new car or provide service on the one that you own, is there a better way to have that experience play out? And in the sense that we've seen it with telephones, we've seen it with transit, bikes, shared things of that nature. We've seen it with subscriptions to department stores or clothing stores, in essence. Is there a way that at some point or another, and they're working on it, that it's a I just bought a Chevy subscription?
Yeah, I mean, as the word that she used, the disruption of people. They want something better out of their experience buying or with their car.
I just think that's great. I'm sure someone can text in and tell me otherwise. But besides the personal stuff about whether you like control or you like driving or you don't trust the fears and the emotions that go into what's going to be driving in the future, I don't think anyone can argue with the idea that a mobility program in which you don't actually own the physical vehicle, but you lease from Chevy, has viability not just from an economic standpoint, but from a consumer standpoint. I get a lot of choices. I can do things different ways. I don't know. Call me new fashion.
Oh, okay.
Not old fashion. I'm new fashion. All right. We're coming up. We're going to play the worst. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It's time for the worst, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. 312-981-7200. You can call or text in your worst. And we're playing for some good stuff tonight. Lou Malnati's gift certificate and a holiday happiness box featuring Sweet Alley's sweet and savory gluten-free treats. Yes, the panel is here tonight. Kristen Toomey, longtime a veteran now of the worst, but also longtime stand-up comedian in town. Kristen, good to see you.
Hi.
We have a newbie in the house. I love it. Darren Varel. Darren, an artist, musician, and he's got a new show that we're going to talk about tonight. But Darren, welcome to the worst. Thanks for playing.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have the show Art Will Fix You. It's the artworks of Darren Varel. It's on December 8th and the 9th, coming up here this weekend. It's at the Chicago Publishers Resource Center at 858 North Ashland, both on Friday night. It's going to be the opening reception. And then on Saturday night, the showcase featuring entertainment, including Kristen.
That's correct. It's about 3 years of mixed media stuff, paintings, graphic design, flyers I've done for bands, concerts, posters, things like that. And just sort of a celebration, you know, it kind of 3 years of my life. And I think that we're going to have this entertainment over here by Kristen Toomey, which is going to really bring the people in more than paintings.
Right.
But we're also going to have entertainment on Saturday from Tom Higginson of the Plain White Tees is
going to
play.
Yeah,
yeah, he'll play about a half an hour set of his music. And then also my brother Eric is going to be performing as well.
Yeah.
Family affair. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good. We'll talk about that throughout the hour. But right now, let's get to the worst. 312-981-7200. And we start the worst like we do every week with Pete Zimmerman. Pete!
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Show-offs at the public ice rink. We get it. You played hockey in high school. You can go backwards.
No, my favorite is the people who did ice skating and they're practicing. Like, oh, I remember I used to do a triple. Let me try it again. And they're like, oh, I screwed it up. Let me try it again. Oh, I screwed it up. Let me try it again. Yeah. Knock it off.
Insufferable.
Go in circles.
Right. Just hug the board.
Hug the board. like a normal person.
You know, how dare you when you see little kids falling and hurting themselves, you just silhouetting around or, I don't know, pirouetting around.
It feels so good.
What are the terms?
Tights.
What are the terms? Tanya Harding. You're just Tanya Harding around.
Triple axle.
Triple axle. That was the big one in The Edge or whatever that movie.
Cutting Edge. That's great. Yeah.
D.B. Sweeney.
D.B. Sweeney.
Yeah. All right.
There you go.
That's the worst.
That's the worst. I don't know. I might say that's the best.
I know. Come on.
No, I like that movie, but I thought I was trying to get us back on track, guys.
I just feel like at the end when they are in the Olympics and they are.
Oh,
I cry. I don't want to spoil it.
I mean, it's like, is she a boomerang? I don't understand. I still don't understand what that final move was exactly, but it was impossible physically.
And it stole my heart. So
yeah, and mine.
Comedy.
Yeah, and I was like, yeah.
I think all of us.
I think it was a moment that we don't talk about as a society enough, frankly.
All right. Kristen, what do you got for the worst?
Our friend Lisa, we grew up with, she texted me this one. So this is for you, Lisa. A wet Band-Aid in the pool.
Oh, jeez.
Dude.
Yeah.
When she texted me that, I was like, absolutely. I remember like seeing, if I saw a Band-Aid in a pool, I was like never going back to that pool. I was all of a sudden not swimming there.
Yeah.
All.
I mean, that's the worst.
Ugh.
It is. That's gross.
It's
that
so
falls
gross.
Into the category of gross. Gross worst. Mm. Yeah. Mm. All right, Darren, what do you got for the worst?
Okay. I got to say, and I don't know if this has been used before. But clickbait,
yes.
Oh, I fall into the trap so much. It'll be like, Obama slams Trump. Like, oh, I gotta see what this is all about, you know? And you click on it,
it's terrible.
It's like, oh, yeah, just like Obama said something about, tweeting today. He didn't mention anyone's name, but he slammed Trump via, you know. And it's like, no, he didn't. And why did I click on this? And now I'm buying sausages from Oscar Mayer, you know, because I clicked on it. Like, just to get me to buy something,
you're
you know?
Duped.
So, right.
Pete had one a while back, which was one of my favorite of all
That's
time.
It's
the worst. Versus when you accidentally like on Instagram a sponsored post.
Ooh. Oh, yeah,
you don't
when
know
they get you.
You're like, ooh, that's a cool picture. And you're like, oh, wait, this is for Target. Ah!
Wait, listen, do you know who the king of that is? Is Diddy. I follow Diddy on Twitter, and he got me good. Because there was a video he posted of
him
dancing. Him dancing. And he was killing it. And so I retweeted it, and then he pulls out his vodka. And I didn't wait until the end of the video. And so he got me. And then I had to tweet him like, that is a genius promo. Like, you totally
And you're
got
probably
me.
The one who's like, no, they'll never get me with ads. They'll never get
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I'm always.
Diddy got you.
Yeah, Diddy got me good.
No, Diddy's going to get you.
Yeah, if anybody's going to get
anybody's
you.
Anybody's
got to,
you know.
It's got to be Diddy.
All right. Let's go to Steve. Let's kick it off tonight. Steve, what's the worst, bud?
Hello.
Hello. What do you got? What's the worst tonight?
Okay, you know what's the worst? When you go to Facebook and you see it's one of your friend's birthdays, mm-hmm. and you click on the link to give them a little, you know, happy birthday message or whatever, and a solicitation for a charity donation comes up with it.
Oh, yeah. That's a new thing, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
you could set that to say in lieu of. Did you?
Steve, is this? Steve? I did that.
I didn't.
You did?
I don't think I donated.
So what happens? Tell us how do you
no,
do
but
this?
It was like I didn't really care. You know, I was.
So you
like,
said instead in lieu of saying happy birthday to me,
they offered
go to a charity?
It like, and they were just like, "Do you want to click on this?" And I was like, "Sure." Like if somebody wants to give money to charity, I'm not gonna be like, yeah, right. "No."
How much did you research that?
That's
though?
Gonna piss off Steve. I'm not gonna do that for the charity.
Yeah.
And
how much research
the,
did you do?
Right.
Are you making sure that money's going?
Yeah, you get to pick who it goes to.
Yeah.
So I mean, I feel
I'm
you,
Steve.
But also, you know, who cares?
Yeah, but I'm with Steve
it's
on that
charity.
One.
For charity.
Thanks, Steve.
I mean, you kind of feel like you're bullied into it, don't you? That,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, I felt bullied into asking for money, but then it's also like people are starving, so, you know.
Because of this
be
job and
fix it.
I don't let people publicly comment on my Facebook page because a lot of people are like, you suck. Yeah. You know, you're like, why do I have this here?
That's what I'm doing right now.
So I just hit the button one time. Says you can't publicly put something on my page. So when it came to my birthday, I didn't change anything. I didn't even think about it. But when it still flashed and told everybody it's my birthday, but it didn't give them the option to put it on my public page. It said, it's just message him. And that was it.
No.
And so I got like 250 messages in Facebook that was like, happy birthday. And the people didn't mean to message you. They just went, happy birthday. They're doing
too
like
many
they do.
Birthday messages.
But I was just like,
the
then what do you do? Do you go, thanks? Because now it's in message, a little more formal than on your.
Right.
There's not a button to hit like on it. Yeah. So you're like, what do you do?
You're like a double jerk if you don't get it back to them in the message part.
Yeah. I'm so much stress over nothing. All right. Darren Varel, Kristen Toomey in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we've got a lot of text to get to. Playing the worst. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
Playing the worst tonight, 312-981-7200. Panelists Kristen Toomey, Darren Varel in studio tonight. They're both part of the Art Will Fix You, Darren's show at the Chicago Publishers Resource Center, 858 North Ashland. The opening reception is on Friday, Saturday the 9th, showcase and entertainment featuring great talent and Kristen.
Oh, great talent and Kristen. You're the worst.
All right. 312-981-7200.
I like when the staff laughs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you get that nice little laugh through the window, right?
Thumbs up.
All right, here we go. Let's see. All right. The worst is the holidays, okay? 7-0-8.
Wow.
When everybody's trying to tell you how to get the cranberries out of the can, like poke a hole in the bottom of the can or run a knife along the inside of the can, all the while four people in the kitchen are telling you how to do this well. The buns are burning in the oven.
I don't eat that. So the cranberry in a can, I have never opened that. Is that hard to get out?
I guess. I
like not, suctions yeah. in?
I don't know. Why are you guys looking at me?
Well, I don't know. But like, it must be like
suction. It must
suctioned.
Be hard. Yeah, it must be hard.
You got to poke a hole in
I would trade that one in to say, like, well, maybe it's the traveling during the holidays, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
If you live in the city and your family happens to live in the suburbs, and then they're like, you know, I'm going to do Christmas and you can do Thanksgiving, but we're all going to do it in the suburbs. That's kind of the worst to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, imagine if you really need cranberry sauce.
Is it sauce? I always get confused. There's the sauce that's like kind of like the relish, but then there's the stuff that almost looks like a blob.
Yeah, it's like a Jello blob.
Yeah,
or
like
something.
The Jello blob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's what.
I mean,
she's
I don't. Yeah, I don't really eat that stuff. But isn't that more Thanksgiving? Or
is that government issued?
Holiday, yeah. It feels like it's got the blob. It's got the blob.
Yeah.
To make sense. It's all right, 773 says the worst is when you're an Uber driver. And you're thinking, maybe I'll get one more ride, and you do it, but it takes you 20 miles from your house when you're just two blocks away.
Yeah.
You just got money. What are you complaining about?
Yeah.
That's not the worst.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, what were you thinking was going to happen by taking one more ride two blocks from your house? Hopefully my neighbor takes the service.
Right.
Yeah, I make a dollar. Yeah, I don't know.
I had a wedding last weekend that I went to in, like, Arlington Heights and Wheeling. It's the most money I've ever spent on an Uber.
Oh my gosh, you know? How much was it?
It was like, I think both ways it ended up costing like $85.
Oh man.
Yeah. It was crazy. I mean, altogether. And I was like, man, I just spent a lot of money. But that, you know, it's worth it not to drink and drive, right?
Right, so, absolutely. Yeah.
But it was like, wow, somebody just made a lot of money tonight.
But you also
saved like $9,000 for getting a DUI.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, you got to look at it like that. Ubers are a life of shame.
But here's my question to that. In a drive that's that long, are you talking to the driver? Or do you go, you know, Chicago, it's downtown?
No, I got to say, I'm kind of a talker myself. So, I enjoy, that's kind of the thing about the art show. It's like, I mean, when we play shows in my band, I don't really get a chance to talk to people because it's loud. And we were just talking about this outside with Kristen. But at the art show, it's like, I can't wait for people to kind of tell me about their stories about stuff. What do they think about the art? Like, I don't know. It's just me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like that.
But I can also appreciate if an Uber driver wants me to shut up. So.
What are the
cues?
It's usually
the other way around, right? Yeah, it's usually if I walk in and I'm like, oh, yeah. How's your night? Pretty good, man. And then the signal has been given, you know.
Yeah,
and then
you
know that.
Or if you put your headphones on,
no
follow up. Really over. Yeah.
Yeah.
No follow up question. Follow-up.
Let's go to Wendy. Wendy, what's the worst, Wendy?
Oh, the worst is when you work an hour overtime.
Okay.
and it takes you an hour and a half to get home when you only live 25 minutes away.
Ugh. Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah. What was happening? It was just
was that
traffic?
Today?
It was traffic on 294.
Today?
Yeah, that was because they had a big accident out there, like a semi went somewhere.
Oh, man. And it took you an hour and a half?
Yes, an hour and a half to get home.
So what was the point? Right. So time and a half, you broke even.
You broke even.
So that's good.
It's exactly what happened.
I don't think anybody in the world is going to debate you on that not being the worst. That's definitely the worst.
Yeah, that is the worst.
He really cut to the heart of this game.
Right,
didn't
you should be eating your pizza already.
All right. Thanks, Wendy.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That is true. She really got right to the, yep. we all know what that feels like. All right. Let's keep going here. Yeah, right.
I know.
The worst is spending last weekend putting up outdoor Christmas decorations only to have the winds of the last 2 days rip them all off.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible.
And now it's not 65 degrees anymore.
Yes, you got to go out there. We all thought we were getting, it's 60 degrees. I'll go out and do some yard work.
Right.
Now you got to redo that work in the 20-degree weather.
I saw a bunch of leaf bags just blown everywhere. You know, just like everyone's hard raking.
All that bending.
Blowing.
My lower back. What?
I know.
Well, I have an inflatable snowman that blows up every morning, you know, and then it kind of waves at the people walking the street.
Yeah.
And today I made the choice. I said, you know what? It's almost like bacteria at the beach. I was like, nope, it's closed. We're not putting this thing up. It's
bacteria at the beach.
It's closed. It's closed.
That's the worst.
It's the worst.
When your holiday decorations are bacteria at the beach.
Same concept.
That's your mindset right now. Merry Christmas, Justin.
There's the E. coli levels of this blow up snowman.
Frosty. Yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. 312-981-7200. All right. The worst is trying to scoop leftover rice out of a Chinese food container without flinging rice everywhere like you're at a wedding.
Dude, rice is so hard to reheat. I mean, you really got to get
the
right.
It's a one-time thing.
You got to get the right drops of water in the right spot.
Yeah. No.
It's weird.
I don't think it's so funny because the concept of Chinese food is that you go get it and you have a lot. You're like, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be leftovers. But a lot of that stuff just gets hardened and hard to heat up, especially the rice stuff. And you're like, what's the point?
It's like rice isn't a two-meal type of food. You know?
Yeah, right.
that's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. All right, 312-981-7200. Here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news with Rob Martyr. We'll come back. We'll continue the second half of The Worst. We're playing for prizes, including pizza, so stay with us. All right, let's play The Worst here. 312-981-7200. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. In studio tonight, Kristen Toomey. Hello. Let me put you on there.
Hello.
Darren Varel. Both panelists tonight are going to be part of the Art Will Fix You, the artworks of Darren Varel, which is opening at the Chicago Publishers Resource Center at 858 North Ashland. Coming up here on Friday the 8th and Saturday the 9th. Kristen Toomey will be performing on Saturday, 858 North Ashland. Check it out.
Real quick. I wanted to say about that. So I found my journal, which is normally the worst when you're reading your journal from a long time ago. But I found my 21-year-old journal and I wrote stand-up in it. And that was way before. So I'm going to be performing the stand-up
that
I wrote in my journal.
That's great.
I didn't even know that. I'm hearing that for the first time. Yeah. Can I just add one more thing to it that I don't know if we talked about, which I think is a very big incentive for people to maybe come. If you are of age, legal drinking age, you can come and we have old-style beer for free of charge for you. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Free beer.
Compliments, sponsored.
Compliments of our friends. It's supported by our friends at Old Style Beer. So we want to send a shout-out to them and say thank you. Thank you, Anthony Spina, and everybody over there involved. Please come. It'll be fun. We'll have a good time.
Yeah.
Free beer for free. Always good. Always
Everything's
good.
Free.
And diary stand-up.
Yeah.
I love it.
You know what? I stayed true to myself. That's what I realized. I was like, I got to let this out.
I love it. Yeah. All right. Well, We'll have to wait to Saturday.
Well, you're going to come, right?
I was excited. Now, I wasn't going to come at all. I was not at all, but now I'm so interested.
See?
I'm intrigued.
Now,
I said the free beer, and then he said he was going
to
come.
The free beer had nothing to do with it. I'm like, free beer. I'll sneak my own beer in. But I want to see Kristen do stand-up for when she wrote it in her journal. What? Yeah. How old are you?
20. And it's like from 20, and then it goes over to my 21st birthday.
I love it. Okay.
But, you know, it's really about Darren.
It's about Darren. Yeah. All right. Good. All right. Here we go. 312 tonight says, you know what's the worst? When your kids take the Whitman chocolate sampler, literally, and sample most of the chocolates and leave those they didn't like bitten into. You bite it, you bought
it. Oh, for sure.
Betty says...
Oh, I'm guilty of that.
You'll bite it and put it back?
I bite it and put it back, and I only like one type, so really I don't know what I'm hoping for.
So why?
That's kind of like an amendment of the worst of people who just see stuff in your office, and they're like, oh, it's free, I'm going to take it, you know? But then it's doubly the worst when they're like, okay, I take it, no, I don't really like it, I'm going to put it back.
So you'll take a bite, you're going with like a little rabbit bite when you go for
like
it?
Yeah, I go like a tiny, I just nip the corner. You know, nip the corner, see what I'm working with, and if I don't like it, if it's pink or something, I put it back. If it's I put it back.
It's such a, like, the moment is so fleeting. Like, if you put the whole thing in your mouth, you're like, oh, I don't like that one. It's over in 5 seconds.
No, but it's also, it lingers if it's a bad taste.
Yeah, but it's chocolate at the end of the day.
Parts of it, and there's also weird pink stuff that I don't know what it is, and I'm not committed.
Oh yeah, you
to
get there is true.
It.
There is the one mystery piece that is toxic.
Yeah, there's always that one that's like, one. Come on, what is it?
Like
poison?
It's not like that jelly bean game where one of them it's like supposed to be barf taste.
Oh yeah,
not like that
game is the worst. Those nasty
rotten eggs. Or
what
something.
Is it? Bamboozled or bamboozled?
Yeah.
My kids had that. It was disgusting.
All right, let's keep going. 630, the worst is when your ex-girlfriend moves out while you're not home, and you return and you're reminded that it was her TV, and it was such a nice TV.
Oh, yeah. Been there.
You have been?
Well, not with the TV so much, but the moving out thing, yeah.
You've had surprise move-outs? I'm intrigued. I get those a lot on the worst. The worst is when I came home and all my stuff was gone. Or I'm like, really? That's a thing?
Well, I can't say I've been there. that sounds very, very cold. Yeah. But definitely the move out. Yeah. So that is the worst, man. I don't want to see that happen to me. That's the worst.
That's the worst. Yeah. Especially if you were really looking forward to maybe checking out the Nathan For You finale or something.
Oh,
and you're I'm going to get home. And then the TV's gone. That's your first thought. Then you're like, where did my fiance go?
Yeah.
TV's
you're
gone.
Looking for body warmth later.
Later. That's later.
And then you're like, she's gone
later.
Too?
And then you're really, really far down the bottle of whiskey later.
Yeah. There's a lot of laters there. But right. Well, that is the worst.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good
one. Yeah,
a front runner.
I agree. That is pretty bad.
331 says, bought $500 pair of tickets to Hamilton. The night of the show, our special needs son came down with bronchitis and double ear infection. Ooh. Had to cancel the babysitter and eat the cost of the tickets.
Oh, man.
You know, you could... Maybe you can't. I don't even know.
I
feel like just being a theater guy, and I feel like you could tell that story to the Hamilton people.
And they'd be like,
yeah, here's tickets. Yes.
Well, he just did, honey. He said it to you.
Yeah,
you just said it to them.
There's a lot of worse in that story, for sure. I had Hamilton tickets on the day of Game 7 of the World Series to see my Chicago Cubs, and it was my mom's birthday present on her birthday. And my mom said, you know what, Darren?
What'd you do?
Try to sell them or just get rid of them. We're going to Wrigley Field to watch the Cubs. Aww, I was like, Mom, you rule.
Oh, that's the nicest.
I remember, I'll tell a story. And
then they won.
Years ago, 15 years ago, I was super into the Bears. They had a freak year where they went to the playoffs.
2006?
2001. Oh, this is Dick Geron and Brian Urlacher and early on. And you're like, wow. But for Christmas, my wife and I at the time, my girlfriend, we got both parents together for tickets to see The Sweet Smell of Success, which is at the Schubert, John Lithgow, Brian D'Arcy James, like big thing.
Awesome.
It was a Christmas, right? But of course, schedule comes out. The Bears game is opposite the opposite time exact matinee, right? So I came up with this huge. This is before cable. This is before DVR. So I had to VCR tape it and everything, and I double tape. And I said, I'm going to the to Broadway Theater. No one's going to talk about the Bears game, right? I'll be fine, right?
No cell phones, by the way.
No cell phones at that time. So you're all good. You're like, okay, I just got to make it through, and we'll get home, and we'll just shut all the doors, and we'll just watch it like it's live. So everything is fine. Nobody does anything. We get to intermission, or maybe the play is over. And Brian D'Arcy James, who's a friend, he comes out. You know, he comes out afterwards, and I'm like, hey, and I introduce him to my family, and he goes, right now, Eagles 7, Bears, and I throttled him. I put my hands on him, the star of the show. There was so much stress of, like, my parents together and with new parents and my wife. I lunged at him.
Oh, my
Like,
gosh.
The whole audience was like, the star of the show is, there's
oh
something wrong. Because I go, shut your... I'm so sorry, Brian.
Okay, you're getting jazzed now. Look at you, out of the chair.
Pizza's awarded. You got it. Way to go. The worst.
This is a good little story. All right, moving on. All right. 630 says, the worst is that I live in a town that stopped selling liquor at 10 p.m. And I got to the register at 10:03, and the cashier told me. Ooh. So I had to go to the next town to score.
Why can't the cashier be like, okay, look, it's 3 minutes?
I don't know.
They
rule.
They probably check, like, the receipts.
Or they shut it down. It's probably a computer. It's like, no.
Yeah, right.
Is that what it does? Yeah. Really? That's the worst. What you just did is the worst.
Come on, I was doing a human Foley artist.
I can relate. That's the worst. You think you're going to get some beer. You had a tough day.
Cash machine.
Red alert, red alert. Booze being sold, red alert. Yeah, you can't.
You had a tough day. You wanted to have a drink. You can't get it because you're 3 minutes late. That's
Yeah, no,
I can relate.
Sucks.
I got
it
one for you. Just real quick. It drives me crazy, and I get very Larry David about it at the Target. But at the Target, when you buy any sort of booze and they ring it up, they scan the little scan thing on the back of your license.
Really?
They don't check the number and look at it and go, oh, 1974, okay, you're good. Mm. They scan it, and then the computer says he's good. And I'm like, stop scanning and putting it on record that I bought this bottle of red wine from Target. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't need you to scan that
it's
I bought
it. It's bad enough I have these invisible drones following me everywhere.
Right. I don't know. I got really annoyed by that. I'm like, there doesn't need a scan of my license. Just look at the number.
Right. Yeah.
There's no social contract for you to scan.
Yeah, now you're going to get ads sent to your house or
I feel like
something.
Someone's scamming me.
You absolutely are going to, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true.
I know.
That stuff's true.
All right, let's go to Jasmine. Jasmine, hey, Jasmine, I haven't heard from you in a while. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. But I've got a worst.
All right,
what's
the worst, Jasmine?
College stuff, applying for schools, the future. I hate it.
I love that. Man, I love that.
Oh, that's
the future is the worst.
My mom wants me to, you know, do community college stuff, but it's not. I feel like it's not real school. Like, you got to get the experience, you know, of 4-year school.
Well, a lot of people do the 2 years college and then they move on to the 4-year college when they're a little bit older. That's also a good
thing. That's what I did. Yeah. I had 2 years of, you know, associates or whatever, and then that was supposed to go into the 4 years at Northern, but instead I just took a job.
The first few months of being a senior are hard, and I'm trying to get perfect attendance this year, so.
And it's going well so far? You got it?
Yeah, I haven't missed a day of school yet, but it's those days when I don't want to get up in the morning.
It's also 10:45, so don't waste it on playing the worst.
Yeah, so I'm going to go to bed.
Tomorrow you're going to be like, you're gonna miss your first day because you were calling in talk shows.
I haven't heard you guys in a while, and I'm sorry about Tribune Tower.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you for that. We're moving out of here.
Tell Patty I said hi, by the way.
We will. I will. I'll see her in just a couple minutes. Thanks, Jasmine.
Bye.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
All right. That's good. The front runner as well. The future.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, the worst is the future. That's my favorite so far. I agree. It's such a grand scale.
Perfect.
It's the best, you know, umbrella you could have.
Yeah.
All right. 312's got a good one. You know what's the worst? Poetry. I don't get any of it. It makes me feel dumb.
You know what? I've thought that before. Like, years ago, I felt angry at poetry. Mm. And then, I thought it was dumb. But then I changed my mind. So, what's this guy's name?
It doesn't give a name, just a phone number.
I can't.
Nameless one, leave your mind open. Maybe you'll change it.
I don't know. I feel like there's never been a better time in the history of poetry to be more open to it.
with the way that the beat poets or even rap and hip hop, there's so much that goes into it that I feel like there's so many entry points.
Exactly.
Well, I think you have to differentiate what poetry you're talking about, right? Because a songwriter is a poet, right? You know.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, our freedom of speech is crucial, and that's a great, beautiful expression of it. Oh,
I'm just doing a backdrop.
You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag.
I wish this was a television show so everyone could see her waving her flag right now.
There it is.
Miss America.
There it is.
God bless.
No, the song is God Bless Miss America. It's a song.
Oh boy.
All right, Kristen Toomey, Darren Verrill in studio. All right, so we'll take a quick break, and we will come back with who's going to win this week at the worst. So stay with us. Playing the worst tonight, 312-981-7200. Kristen and Darren in studio. All right, 262 says the worst is motion sensor lights in restrooms. I don't know how many times I've had to use my cell phone to see after the lights go out.
That actually has happened to me in an IKEA in the UK.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Like the lights just go off?
Yes. And I thought for real somebody came in there and turned them off. So I got to tell you, that's the worst from experience. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, having to wave your arms around.
But I mean, but that doesn't help. Well, at least in the UK it doesn't.
What do you have to do? Like get up?
Yeah.
And walk around.
Yeah, what do you do?
Yeah, you just said
with
it.
Your pants. With your pants down, I meant.
And then the light comes on and somebody walks in and it's a sitcom.
Yeah, and then you have your pants down. Right, your pants I suppose down. You can pull up your own pants in the dark.
Bang, bang, bang. Yeah. It's like George Seinfeld walking up.
Right.
Larry David's in the handicap stall. Yeah.
847 says, the worst is having to thank a friend for lending me her car and then having to tell her that a big branch fell on it. This afternoon during the windstorm.
Oh, we got a big reaction back here.
Yeah.
That was
Pete Groen.
Through the soundproof glass, even.
773 says, greeting, getting on a CTA bus when high school lets out.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I have a friend, Michael Robinson, who's a Chicago comic that has a great bit about that. So you should look him up, people.
All right, there you go. The worst... needing cash back from a purchase and pressing the wrong button and being denied the cash back. It's because you hit the wrong button. 312 says the worst is when you get...
I fell asleep during that one. I just like... What happened about cash back?
No, they just when you hit the wrong... Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
Well, that's how...
312, the worst is when you
get... It'll be just more of that. Sass. So you shouldn't. If you don't like that, then stay home.
That's not your brand of comedy, sass?
Go
stay home.
I self-sabotaged by booking you on my art show.
That's right.
See, you got to give them a little bit.
312 says the worst is when you get caught in the shirt or sweater you're pulling off. It's stuck and you're like a poor dog trapped in a cone collar.
Oh, my gosh.
Someone else has to get the darn thing off you.
That's so true. I got stuck in a Forever 21 dressing room. And it was like 127 hours. I could not get out of a dress that I put on. I literally ended up like hulking, Hulk Hoganing myself out of the dress and like shredding it like an animal and just leaving it and getting out of there. And I was like, you know what? I'm too old for Forever 21 anyway.
The moral of the story.
That was, the moment.
514 says, when you meet someone you haven't seen in a while and you say, hey, you look great. And they say, hey, would it kill them to just lie?
Yeah, yikes.
Yeah. And the worst is still remembering the name of every girl and a few guys who had bathroom accidents during class.
Oh.
I still have all class pictures from my 8 years of Catholic school. I can still remember 90% of their names and which ones had accidents in class. Yeah. What are you talking about?
It sounds like you're the worst.
Jerry's like this.
I'm joking, Jerry. Please don't write anything about me.
There's folklore in like high school about that kind of stuff, though. There really is.
Yes.
Remember in ours, like the 3-liter bottle thing? I won't say the name, but you remember people got expelled for going to the bathroom to try to like get a glimpse of this thing. There was lines around the block for it.
We went to the same high school.
214 says, when you spaz out and drop a foul ball in front of your new girlfriend at the Cubs game. Really? That's a, okay.
Is that the guy that had to leave?
I feel like
and moved to Florida. What was the guy's name? That he had? He dropped.
He dropped a foul. And he had
foul, and he it ruined Steve his Bartman. Life. It ruined his entire life.
I don't know. I feel
it was Princeton. A terrible date. Terrible date. The guy he was trying to impress a date, and it just he's changed his name.
This is a
he
new
lives
show
in.
For you. Kristen Toomey presents new or
news,
different scenarios.
News.
Yeah,
news how I see it. News how I think it should have been.
779 Larry. Hi, Larry. Larry says the first day of a sale for an item, and I get there when the store opens, they don't have the sale product, and they offer a rain check.
Yeah, you want it now, right?
Yeah. 708 says the worst is when dad pays $185 per month for the family cell phone plan, and no one in the family ever answers their cell phone. Okay. My guess is that dad is writing that, even though it sounds like not.
Yeah, that's
it's a dad.
You know
complaint.
What? That sounds like sad. And it's sounds December. Like we and can't they, handle that.
They're just like, I got to pay my own cell phone bill, so I don't know.
And they never answer like the phone.
Sad, sad show.
And then the last one here, 214 says, the worst is when you get the critical alert from Microsoft. Critical alert. Your computer has been infected by a virus.
Gosh.
Now you're going to blackmail the crap out of you.
Dude, you got to get a voiceover
agent.
Please
call us immediately at 1-800.
For all robots. Right? You should be Suri's voice.
I'd be a great robot.
Turn right.
All right, there we go. All right, so here's what we got to give away tonight for the top three. We've got a holiday happiness box featured by Sweet Alley's sweet and savory gluten-free treats.
And they are delicious. I'm gluten-free. Yeah. I love them.
Visit Sweet Alley's Bakery in Hinsdale and Glenview for holiday celebrations. We got one of those. And we've got a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. All right, so here's who's going to get the pizza. Let's go with 262. The worst is motion sensor lights in restrooms.
Yes.
I don't know how many times I had to use my cell phone to see after the lights go out. And then the other pizza is going to go to 630 that says your ex-girlfriend moves out while you're not home. You return and you're reminded that it was her TV.
Oh, man.
All right, I like that. I mean, I don't love that, but I like the fact that they got pizzas.
And we're going to give the Sweet Alley's happiness holiday happiness box to Wendy, who called in, who complained about overtime because she was stuck in that traffic on 294. Mm. And
oh,
literally, that is the worst.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really, and I feel bad I was mean to the first guy.
No, you weren't mean.
What was his name, Pete?
No, not even at all.
Mike.
No, it wasn't even Mike, I don't think.
Joe.
Steve.
Nailed it.
How about
nice
that?
Nice job,
Steve.
Darren.
I guess I'm the only one who cares.
I know.
Cares.
All right. In Steve studio tonight was something. Darren Vorel and Kristen Toomey. Darren's art show, Art Will Fix You, is December 8th and 9th. That's this weekend. Chicago Publishers Resource Center, 858 North Ashland. The opening reception for the art exhibit will be on the 8th, but the big show is on the 9th, the showcase and entertainment, which features Kristen to me, as well as others. It's free to the public. You get free beer from Old Style, and Darren's work will be on display. Can't thank you enough, both of you, for coming in studio. Darren and Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for The Download. We'll be back on Thursday, Blackhawks tomorrow night. Capitals, so we'll be back Thursday night. Patty Vasquez up next. Hey, Patty.
Hi, how are you doing, Justin?
Good to see you.
I feel like you and I have like traded when we take time off. Are you using up all your last days of the year?
That's exactly what's happening, right?
That's what I'm doing, too.
And then there's Blackhawks and Northwestern, so weird times that we never see each other.
But you guys are doing, you'll be streaming during the games also.
Yeah,
right?
we're going to start doing that in 2018.
Excellent.
Yeah,
wonderful.
So what's on the show tonight?
We have Jen Zanotti, who actually was teaching us our jiu-jitsu class, which you were not present for.
I was
for.
Not present for. I saw the picture.
It was amazing.
Intense.
I'm going to so throw you over my hip and slam you against the wall and then put you in a chokehold and then turn your wrist.
I don't know why I missed it. I don't know why I was really like, fun. Oh, I don't know if I want to go.
We also have the AV Club's John Tatey and Steve Van Dinter, our tech guy. So it's
all
coming
right.
up.
There
have,
you go.
Have a lovely evening.
You too. Take care.